It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight. Again, we're going to be in the nation's capital in front of the Lyndon Baines Johnson U.S. Department of Education building for Occupy 2.0, Occupy the DOE 2.0. Going to be going through some of the emails, going to talk to some activist educators. That's the main focus for this evening. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind about the event, if you've missed any portion of our coverage yesterday, you can make sure you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Big job numbers out today. 88,000 jobs created. The unemployment rate goes down by one tick of a percent, one-tenth of a percent there. What can you say? We've lost another 3,000 manufacturing jobs. We haven't kept up with expectations. We haven't kept up with the demographic shift. I don't know how unemployment goes down in a month when you have such paltry, pathetic job numbers like what we've seen. And to me, it highlights, again, the fact that we have done nothing. We have done absolutely nothing on the jobs front. We have done nothing to create jobs. We've done nothing to invest in our infrastructure. We've done nothing to invest in our education and healthcare and all of the things that we need to be doing. All I keep seeing are more cuts, more gutting, more punishing. And being out here in the nation's capital, talking about education, really highlighting the fact that over the last four and a half years, what we've seen going on is an all-out assault on public workers. And again, another month where we lost more public sector workers. Mission accomplished, GOP. Mission accomplished, corporatists, as we move away from the public sector. And where? Well, nowhere, because the jobs aren't being created. I was just watching something on TV last night. While I was in the hotel room here, a rich guy talking about, well, we need to get government out of job creation. We need to get government out of the economy. And I'm going, well, you know what? I'm sorry, but this whole concept of the free market, it's not working. It's not. I'm sorry. The free enterprise system, while it may sound great on paper, it just not seem to be working because at the end of it, and you go back through time, and you know, I go back to the guy I met in Florida who worked in the aerospace industry for years. All of the things that came out of government spending, all of the things that came out of investment, all of the things that came out of our infrastructure, and all of the research and development that's, well, now being put onto the private sector. Are they doing it? Well, you look at these paltry job numbers, the answer is a resounding no. Corporate profits, fantastic. Wall Street, fat and happy. CEO pay, perks, benefits, all that stuff, wonderful. You know what's not? Well, no job creation. 88,000 jobs in the month when they were expecting 190. Lost 3,000 manufacturing jobs. You know, I look at this and I keep asking the question, what's it going to take? Yet all we're being fed and being force-fed is more division, more divisiveness, more shiny stuff. We're still talking about the wine and spirit shops. We're still talking about the lottery. We're still talking about all of these things that aren't job creators, but they're ideological. And that's what's frustrating to me, and that's what's frustrating to a lot of the people that I've met recently here at this event that we're at in Washington, D.C., is we're frustrated. The real problems that are pressing, the real problems that our nation faces, we don't seem to be addressing. And to me, that's what should be angering, what should be taking people to the streets, which is why we came out to this event. And we hope that you've enjoyed it. Tonight we're going to be talking to folks, educators, parents, students, activists, because the mainstream media has really, and I guess you could take the cynical view that they're bought off. Which part of me says they're just lazy, and there's the other part says maybe it's true. Maybe the cynical view is they're bought off. I mean, on the education front, you know, when was the last time the local public school advertised in the newspaper? When was the last time the local public school advertised on radio or television? When they buy ads promoting themselves? Let me think. Hold on. Never. They don't do that because they're there for the common good, not for the common, for the single-minded profit. But I see a lot of the profiteers. I see a lot of ads for that. Got a couple of emails last night from our coverage. Very positive. Look, you know, the one woman wrote, hey, I didn't realize that this was going on. Is this happening in my school? Because, you know, and she reiterated what I said yesterday, that we all think that it's just like when we went to school. Things don't change. The school's the school. It is what it is. And the more you look at it, the more you go, you know, our tax dollars are being spent to enrich these big corporations. And a lot of people, I don't think, get what's behind the local school. You think, well, you know, the local teacher makes up the test and gives it to the kids. It's not like that anymore. It's not like when I was a kid and the teacher would go down and mimeograph off a test. I mean, they don't even have mimeograph machines anymore, but they would go down and they'd photocopy the test right there, and they would grade it right there. That's not the way it is anymore. Now it's all, here's this big corporation who's come out with this book, probably printed in places like China. We've got a lot to do. And for me, the education, why this is so important and why this is so personal to me is because I don't know that you can have any type of functional democracy, or even the representative democracy that we have, without an active, informed, and engaged electorate, and one that's able to look at what's going on, analyze problems, and come to solutions. I worry that we're moving towards the generation of button pushers who know which buttons to push but have no idea why. I fear that we've become a compliant society, one that's thrown our hands up and said, you know what, we can't solve our problems. I'm hopeful in the vein that, look, there are people out on the street here, hundreds of people here at the Department of Education in Washington, saying, you know what? We want a better future for our kids. We want a new direction. We don't want to be on the charter path. We don't want to be on the privatization path. We want to be on what's good for the country path. And it's an interesting thought. You know, on Monday this week, we were in Charleston, West Virginia. And see, these are the kind of things that have got to scare the planners. These are the things that have to scare the wealth class of this country, that there are people willing to take to the streets, that they've done a great job of separating us, of dividing us, of keeping us pitted against one another. But what we're seeing is we're seeing that grassroots organizing. We're seeing that groundswell of something's not right. And while I've been talking about this education thing for years, while I've been talking about charter schools and this whole profitization and privatization of our education system, I think there are people who are coming around as well. And, you know, while the wealth class may have the money and may have the media structure. We have out-procreated them. There are more of us. And the more that we talk to our neighbors, the more we talk to our friends and our family, and the more we get involved in our local community and our schools, and the more we take part in each other's lives, the more I think we can change this country. It can be the country that we want. It can be the place that we want it to be. But, you know, I see what happened in West Virginia on Monday, and I'm in awe. Look, you had 7,000 miners taking to the streets saying, you know what, we're going to fight you. We're going to fight you on stealing our benefits. They're not used to that. They're used to imposing their will. They're used to getting their way, running companies into deep debt, and then running them through bankruptcy. And I look at these miners, man, and, you know, if we allow that to happen to them, if we allow them to steal those health care benefits from those retirees, the most vulnerable, people have given 30, 40, 50 years. One guy met 50 years in the mines walking around with his oxygen tank. If we allow them to steal health care from folks like that, the most vulnerable, what does it say about us? What does it say about what we're willing to allow to happen? You know, for me, it's about taking care of the least among us. You know, you go back to that whole idea, wow, we're a Christian nation. Are we? When we're willing to allow the most vulnerable to be exploited, when we're allowing them to be pushed to the edges, I don't know. We're going to find out. And over the next couple of days, weeks, and months, we're really going to find out about what it is about us. So here for the next 2 hours, you're going to listen to some interviews, some conversations I'm going to have with activists, educators, teachers, students, folks from all across the country here at the Occupy, the DOE 2.0 from Washington, D.C. If you have any questions, any thoughts, anything on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I will answer all emails personally. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The union does not condone cheating by anyone. If it's our member, we don't condone it. Our profession should have high standards, and we do have high standards. And in fact, 99.99% of our educators were never even touched in Atlanta or named in a report.
Georgia Federation of Teachers President Verdelia Turner talking about the arrests of 35 Atlanta public school educators in a test cheating scandal. Turner says the union blew the whistle on test cheating back in 2005, but was ignored.
In Atlanta in particular, our voices were not heard, and we were ignored.
Turner says not enough emphasis is placed on learning and teaching in our schools, while too much emphasis is placed on standardized tests. And Turner says when teachers have a voice in the classroom through their unions, public education results are often better. 45 years after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life fighting for the union rights of Memphis sanitation workers, those workers are once again fighting for their jobs against a privatization effort. Chad Johnson is executive director of AFSCME Local 1733 in Memphis. He says privatization will hurt public services and hurt these workers.
We're standing up for basic services for all citizens. We're standing up also that no matter what job you have, you should be paid a decent wage, decent benefits, and have decent working conditions. It's that simple. And that unfortunately, we have the powerful in Memphis have forgotten the lessons from 1968, and we're going to remind them. This is an effort to bust a union in what many call the heart and soul of the union movement, because what happened in 1968 was that rare, perfect example that civil rights are labor rights.
Hundreds of fast food workers in New York City walked off their jobs Thursday demanding higher wages and the right to form a union without intimidation. Chicago's Workers Organizing Committee stands in solidarity with the New York City workers. The New York City fast food workers say they work for corporations that reap huge profits while the workers who make those profits possible struggle with wages they can't live on. More information on the New York City fast food workers movement is available at fastfoodforward.org. Utility workers in Glendale, California are asking for mediators to be brought in to help end a contract dispute with the city. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 18, were denied a request for mediators by the city, a decision that was agreed with by California's Public Employee Relations Board. The city argues that Glendale Water and Power workers applied too late for a mediator. The IBEW argues that the board didn't correctly interpret the law, so they filed a lawsuit with a Los Angeles Superior Court judge. Negotiations broke down over the city's final contract proposal, which would have workers take a pay cut of 1.75% if they choose not to pay more for retirement benefits. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, rickshows.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickshow.com. Of course, you can listen to a portion of our program. You can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. It's been 45 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And you go back and you think about why was he in Tennessee? What was he doing down there? Helping workers. That's what he was doing, which is why I find it really kind of ironic that here we are 45 years, we're still fighting the same fights that we've been fighting for, well, like generations now. And I've got Galen Monroe, Communications Director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Galen, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, no, thank you for having us on. It's always great to be on here.
You know, I look at this, you know, it's 45 years since the assassination. He was in Tennessee for to support workers.
Right, sanitation strike,
and
absolutely.
And here we are. Still fighting the same fight.
It's a travesty. 45 years later, here we are again, and we're battling these massive corporations like Republic Allied Waste. They're a billion-dollar company making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and yet they are still sitting down and trying to squeeze every penny they can in negotiations with our union members on the ground. And that leads us to our current issue, which is we have a number of workers out on strike in Youngstown, Ohio. They work at a Allied Waste location called Carbon Limestone Landfill, and they've been forced out to do a labor practice strike because Republic is still pushing and trying to get concessions out of them at the table.
Concessions.
Concessions. This is a company making hundreds of millions of dollars every year, and these are workers that have experienced incredible pressure from the company, whether it's illegally changing their working conditions without bargaining, refusing to provide pertinent information at the bargaining table, just violations of federal labor law that are just violating their rights on the job every day. And this is not something that is unique. This is something that Republic has and Allied Waste has done in many, many locations across the country. This is a pattern. They are trying to enrich their shareholders at the expense of their labor force. And, you know, this is not an easy job. This is not a job that 95% of the people in the world want to do. This is a job that is absolutely
When I was job. In college, I worked on the back of a Packer myself.
There you go.
This is not easy work.
It is not. In fact, it's the fourth most dangerous job in the country. They are twice as likely to be killed on the job as police officers, seven times more likely than firefighters. And yet, we still have this company marginalizing exactly what they do. Squeezing them for wages, squeezing them for concessions at the bargaining table, wanting them to give up things like their benefits when you have a job that they could suffer a serious injury at any time, any day on the truck. And yet they want to pull things like the great benefits that we fought to get for them, health care, pension, providing for their family is an important thing. What if they got injured long term? What if they're God forbid, killed? You know, we have to make sure that these workers' rights are protected. And so when they're attacking these workers in Youngstown, we've extended these picket lines from Youngstown to places in Illinois, in Indiana, and now we've actually done it in California, five locations in the East Bay area today. And we have hundreds of workers out on honoring these picket lines. And we need to send a message to them that when they attack one group of workers, just because it's in Youngstown, Ohio, they're not isolated there. They are attacking their entire union workforce that works at Republic or Allied Waste.
You know, I wish that mentality would equate into the labor force as a whole, because I do believe in that concept of solidarity, that an injury to one is truly an injury to all, and that we are all in this together. And I know those sound like cliches and they sound like, you know, just slogans, but I truly believe it. I think my listeners believe that as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if we cannot stand together, we are never going to be able to fight against these companies that have unlimited resources. You know, we have to make sure they understand that these are people. These are people with families. These are people that are trying to provide in a very tough economic climate right now. And the more concessions they demand of them, despite them making millions of dollars in profits, the more concessions they demand, the weaker our middle class gets. So we have to stop it now. We have to take a stand. We have to fight the same fight that Martin Luther King Jr. fought 45 years ago. We need to take up his flag. We need to continue this fight.
So let me ask you, Kaylee, and you hear a lot of these companies and you see a lot of it in the news, you know, asking for concessions. And look, I understand when times are tough, if companies are struggling, you do need to help.
Right.
You do need to make sure that, you know, things are going in the right direction. But, you know, as you point out, this is a very profitable company.
Extremely
Have
profitable.
They had, I mean, is there something they could point to in the past? Say, you know, well we had a good year, and that's not the history of our company.
No.
I mean, anything, the CEOs taking concessions?
No.
Are we seeing any of the perks being taken?
Not at
back?
All. Not at all. In fact, this company, Allied Waste, was acquired by Republic, and Republic, by acquiring Allied Waste, and you don't acquire another company unless you're doing well, became the second largest waste company behind Waste Management, I believe, in the country. This is not a company that's suffering. I'm sure that everyone at the top is making plenty of money. It's only down at the worker level, the labor level, that they seem to be trying to make their bottom line fatter.
Well, that's just not the waste industry. That's every industry.
Right, it is.
And I guess the difference here is that these workers actually have the Teamsters to represent them, have a voice, and have the ability to come forward. And I was in West Virginia on Monday, where the mine workers, you know, their retirees are getting their health care stolen.
Another dangerous job, absolutely.
Another extraordinarily dangerous job. And when I look at this, I go, you know, at some point, do we not get it as a working class that there's an assault on all of us?
Mm-hmm.
And while it's the mine workers on Monday and now the trash workers, eventually we're all going to be in this boat. And as the mine workers asked, are you next? And my point on this is I think we are all next.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of who are we going to let go first.
Right. I think that it's important to make the middle class understand that it's not just blue-collar workers that are at risk here. We're just the first domino. You know, and as soon as they have a path to eliminating our benefits, eliminating our good wages, eliminating good-paying jobs, there's nothing to stop them from going up the ladder and attacking white-collar jobs that aren't traditionally thought of to be in this situation. So, absolutely, this is a fight that is not, you know, limited to blue-collar workers and not limited to your traditional labor people that would identify with labor. If you sit at a desk, your job could be just as easily at risk if this trend continues.
What's this mean to the families in Youngstown right now? Youngstown's the heart of this, and you do, as you've said, this is extended to other places. What's it mean to the families? Because, you know, as someone who's been on strike a couple of times in my life, it's a hardship on the family, and it's a hardship on the future of the family.
Right. Well, you know, we do have the strike fund. We are trying to help them in any way we can. And, you know, the old saying is that no one wins in a strike, and it's true. But we do have to stand up, and these men, brave men and women, are standing up for their rights. And they understand the risks they're taking. They understand but they do understand what they're standing up for. And as a lesson that, you know, you really have to learn if you're going to be part of a labor movement.
Well, you know, when I first started, you know, 20-some years ago as a Teamster, an old-timer took me aside and said, look, kid, you better put some money away, have 6 months in the bank, because at any second you need to stand up and defend what it is we've fought for you to have.
Absolutely.
And that's something that I think has been forgotten the last generation. This idea that you need to have a little bit set aside for when tough times come. Mm-hmm. Not just personally, but you look at our state and federal government. I think they've forgotten that as well.
No, I agree. I agree completely. You have to save for a rainy day, as they say. And you know, the labor movement, that's always important.
You know, and I look at this, and you know, I wonder how, you know, when is this going to come to Pennsylvania? Does it affect anyone in our state? And the other part of this is, how do we help?
Well, the the fact of the matter is that the picket lines can be extended to anywhere across the country. And that's what we want this company to understand, is that this is not about only about Youngstown. It's about all of our members that work in this industry, that work at Republic, that work at Allied Waste, that we are going to extend these picket lines and put pressure on the company to sit down at the negotiating table and come to a good agreement for these workers. This is what we did in 2012 with Mobile, Alabama. We extended picket lines when we had issues with Republic Allied Waste there. And eventually it did work. This strategy did work. And so we are enacting the same strategy here. These workers are committed. They know what they have to do to make sure that they come out still standing tall at the end of this.
This is the Rick Smith Show with Galen Monroe, communications person with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. You know, we hear a lot about what goes on, and like you said, no one wins in a strike. But, you know, what's going on at the bargaining table sometimes is important, and what it's over. And I hear a lot of people talk about, when people go on strike, it's because they're greedy and they want money. I rarely find that to be the case. I generally find you're talking about safety, you're talking about health, you're talking about benefits, you're talking about future retiree benefits, things like that. I'm curious, in this situation, what seems to be the sticking point, or is this another one of these moments where a corporation has just decided, you know what? We're gonna do the union avoidance thing. We're going to try and break the union and kick them out altogether.
Unfortunately, I think it's more the latter than anything else. I mean, we don't think that we're just asked for anything unreasonable at the bargaining table. And this strike isn't about, you know, negotiating per se. It's about the violations that the company have made to federal labor law, changing working conditions and not providing information key to negotiations. But this is a trend with this company. We have right now 8 locations, including Youngstown, that have contracts that have expired without a negotiated solution. So this is a pattern with this company, and we have to make sure that they understand these are the consequences of not sitting down and negotiating a fair contract. Not only Youngstown, but Evansville, Urbana, Memphis, Cleveland, Toledo, Atlanta, Pensacola. These are all locations that do not have a contract settled past their expiration date with this company. And so it's important that we take a stand and let them know that we're going to fight to make sure that these workers have the best representation and receive industry-leading contracts.
So let me ask you this, you know, and because I've often said our federal labor law is extremely broken, it's outdated. I thought, you know, the Obama administration, the first thing they should have done was pass the Employee Free Choice Act and maybe update our labor law a little bit. How much of it is that? How much it is that these companies have been getting away with this stuff for so long that it's just standard operating procedure, and how much of it is it's just the culture?
I think it's really the culture, frankly. I think it's almost accepted that this is what's going to happen, is that even profitable, successful companies, corporations are going to sit down and try and squeeze anything they can out of the labor contract. They feel beholden to their shareholders. They feel that it's important to get as much profit out of the company as possible, regardless of what the public might perceive as squeezing labor, squeezing unions, because they feel that the mighty dollar rules everything. And people are not men and women. They're numbers.
They're numbers, right.
And, you know, they're just another entry. Right. They're just another entry on a sheet, and they just need to try and fatten up that bottom line somehow. And, you know, even with Republic, I mean, Bill Gates, a great philanthropist, I couldn't talk there, with his own foundation, he's one of the large shareholders in this company. And you wonder where the disconnect is. You know, why isn't he doing something to help these workers? You know, if he's so bent, and his wife is they're so bent on doing good, why does this exist here in this company that he's such a large shareholder in?
That's a good question. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, when you start talking about these large investors, it's about the bottom line.
Right. Absolutely.
And we need to change that culture.
Yeah, and all we can do is what we're doing now. I mean, of course, things have to happen here in Washington, D.C., for us to enact change. But until then, we need to fight on the ground as best we can.
Last question I have for you. How do we help? What does the average person do? Because, you know, it's my thought that, you know, as I'm thinking about this company, a lot of what they get is through tax dollars. A lot of what they get is, municipal contracts. What can we do to help?
Well, what we can do is let Republic Allied Waste know that we're fed up with what they're doing, that we're tired of the way they're treating communities when they hurt these workers. When they attack these workers, they're not only attacking the workers, they're attacking the community, because these workers are responsible to a certain degree in protecting public health. You know, they pick up what we don't want anymore. And who knows what's in those bags that they pick up? Who knows what they're... I mean, you were on a truck. I'm sure you've seen some some nasty things in the past. And that we value these workers. We value what they do. They can go and they can get more information at our website for this issue. It's www.pickupthegarbage.com. They can follow updates at Repub Teamsters on Twitter. And we also have a Facebook page where they can show their support at Republic Services Teamsters. Any support they can show in the public will help us in the long run. Talk to the municipalities if they have a Republic or Allied Waste contract locally and tell them that they're not going to stand for this kind of behavior by the company.
We will make sure we get those links out at thericksmithshow.com. All that stuff will be under Galen Monroe's name. Galen, I appreciate the time. I wish your workers and your members the best of luck. And if there's anything we can do, we're here for them.
Thank you, Rick. You're always great help.
Thanks so much, Galen Monroe, communications person for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. We're talking.
To the Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Is America truly the land of the free when working families have to struggle to survive? Are workers free to achieve the American dream?
The Teamsters Union is North America's strongest union. We fight for our 1.4 million members and all of America's working families. Teamsters are fighting for the rights of the middle class in Washington, in state capitals, in city councils, and most important, in the workplace. Join us in the fight to keep the American dream alive.
Connect with the Teamsters Union at Teamster.org, Facebook, and Twitter.
It's back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
I got 800 miles of open border.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you've missed any coverage of our coverage here at Occupy the DOE 2.0, just go to the website, thericksmithshow.com, or get the Stitcher app. Anything on your mind, questions, comments, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I listened to that, you know, that conversation with Galen, and, you know, I remember back, you know, my years working on the back of a garbage truck, really very dangerous, very dirty, miserable, just hard work. And, you know, I remember back breaking, I was a young man at the time, I was, you know, 18, 20 years old,
you know, working back there. Just really very dangerous work, very heavy lifting, all of that. And, you know, you think about the kind of disrespect, you think about the kind of, well, the mentality that goes into saying, well, you know, we can pay you minimum wage, we can pay you next to nothing, we can get anyone like you to do this work. It really shows me just what corporate America thinks of us. And, you know, I was thinking about a couple of the people that I worked with over the years. One guy got hit by a car on the back of the Packer. And, you know, Galen hit on it. It's a very dangerous, very, very, very hard job. And you look at these employers, and it's not just the sanitation workers. You know, it's mine workers. It's construction workers. It's workers in general. And, you know, I go back to what, you know, the sign said at the mine workers rally. You know, are you next? You know, who's next in all of this? And I argue we all are. At some point, you know, we've got to say, you know, we're not going to take it anymore. And I look at this situation at Republic, and it seems it's always a constant fight. It's always a constant battle. And I guess, you know, that's how it's always been. Maybe for too long we thought, you know, things, you know, especially when unions were stronger, when you had 30-35% of the workforce as members, you know, we thought maybe, hey, we won. Not so much. And I look at, you know, 2008 when Obama took off, when Obama won, and in 2009 when he took over, a lot of people looked at it, hey, we won. Well, you know, you see the news today? Chain CPI. What we were just talking about the other day, getting him to say he wasn't going to do, well, it looks like chain CPI is in the future of Social Security. And what's that going to mean? You know, it's not bad enough that we've got corporations who are trying to screw their workers. Now you've got our governor, our government, you know, doing the same thing. This chain CPI at every turn. At every turn, the attacks are there, and I know it's easy. I know it's easy to throw up your hands and say, you know what, we can't change it. I know it's easy to say, you know things seem insurmountable. We can't change it. I think we can. Which is why, you know, here at this event, well, the reason we came out here is to talk to the activists, talk to the educators, talk to people who are standing up and fighting back and saying, hey, come with us. Not follow me, but come with us. Stand together with us. All of us. And that's not just education. That's not just on the job. That's part of American life. That's part of what we should be doing as a nation, standing together. I wonder how much longer it's going to take. I'm encouraged, and as I've said before, I'm encouraged by some of the things I've seen recently. I'm encouraged by the fact that you've had the 7,000 to 10,000 mine workers who took to the streets. I'm encouraged by the hundreds of people who showed up to this event. I'm encouraged by hearing the stories that we've brought you the last couple of hours, and the stories that we brought you yesterday of people in their communities all across the country who have stood up and said, you know what, we're going to do the hard work of organizing, not for a profit, not because there is something in it for us, but because it's right, because it's what's best for our country. You know, and you look at this and you go, at some point maybe we will win. But for me, it's about my kids. And a lot of these folks that I've met, it's about that next generation. It's about getting what we had. And I know it's easy to go, well, you know, nothing's changed. Schools are just what they were, you know. And it's easy to buy into the rhetoric because it's everywhere. Everywhere you turn, the schools are failing. You hear it all the time. But are they? What's the definition of failing? Are these insane test scores that we keep hearing about? You know, and the more I talk about these tests with experts, with people who this is their life, the more I realize this is not the answer. And I remember when No Child Left Behind came out, I said, that was not the answer. And it amazes me. It amazes me that my most ardent anti-government people aren't fighting this the most. See, this is one of those bipartisan, nonpartisan issues that I think all of us can come together on. Tea Party, Republican, conservative, liberal, progressive, whatever. Whatever your label is, whatever flag you crawl under, I think this is a uniting issue. And if we can and are willing to stand up and fight back. And look, on the state level, all the charter bills are there. On the state level, all of this stuff is right there. And you've got a good, most of the Republicans in favor of it, and a couple of Democrats who are in favor of more charterizing and more privatizing education. Something we need to be right now actively working to fight back on. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Chicago activist and parent Matt Farmer. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon is solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the worker.
War on the worker.
Proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Power, there is power in our hands. Power, we stand and fight together. There is power in the union of many lands. Power, come and reach across the border. Power, come and open up your eyes. Power, we stand and fight together.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in Labor's Forgotten Massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer Massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Well, it's cold. It's been outside all day. You ready? What are you playing?
Nothing yet.
Time. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. And, of course, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. It's been 45 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And you go back and you think about why was he in Tennessee? What was he doing down there? Helping workers. That's what he was doing, which is why I find it really kind of ironic that here we are 45 years later still fighting the same fights that we've been fighting for, well, I guess generations now. And I've got Galen Monroe, Communications Director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Galen, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, no, thank you for having us on. It's always great to be on here.
You know, I look at this, you know, it's 45 years since the assassination. He was in Tennessee for the...
You're a proud defender of the working class majority.
Here we are.
Rick Smith.
Still fighting the same fight.
It's a travesty. 45 years later, here we are
Rick
again.
Rick Smith Show. We are here in Washington, D.C. Occupy the DOE 2.0. Talking to educators, activists, organizers, students, people from across the country who come out to support public education and to push back against the path that we're on. I'm sitting here with Matt Farmer, an attorney and a parent activist in the Chicago area. Matt, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, we've had you on the program a number of times. What brings you out here to D.C. from Chicago?
Well, you know, I missed Arnie Duncan, our gift to the nation, and just wanted to come back and connect with Arnie to talk hoops, which I think he knows a lot more about than he does education. You know, I think if we could find a neutral third-party site in another country to set him up for retirement, we'd all be best served on the education front.
I look at this, and I go, you know, maybe that's not a bad idea, given the destruction that he's done to education. And I do believe he's done some real damage to this country, education-wise, and to the future of our country.
Well, we're staying in a hotel right across the street from the Department of Education, and when I walked downstairs this morning, I saw a large contingent from FEMA in the hotel. And I'm hoping they are here to address the destruction that is the Department of Education, the crisis there. But who knows?
But now in Chicago, I understand why 54 schools are closing.
54 schools are on the hit list, which is the largest school closing in the country in the United States history, unprecedented.
And that's down from what, 120, 129, I think?
Well, we don't know what it's down from. The way this works in Chicago is the Board of Education at some point in time puts out a list of schools that meet the criteria for closing. And those criteria change from year to year. This year, it was about the so-called underutilization of schools rather than the academic performance of schools. So initially, we were told there were upwards of 300 schools in Chicago that met the criteria. There was a series of meetings around town and reports issued by a so-called independent commission, the chairman of whom has a charter school in Chicago named after him. The list of 300 schools was whittled down to, I think, initially 129. At which point the commission issued a report saying we recommend you can close comfortably 80 schools. The district then decided upon the magic number of 54. Interestingly, they did that on the same day that Bears linebacker Brian Urlacher, number 54, was released by the Chicago Bears. So it may have just been a sick tribute to him to come up with that 54 number.
So I know those sound like cliches.
I'm not sure. I've got some people looking into it.
I truly believe it. I think my listeners believe that as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if we cannot stand together, we are never going to be able to fight.
That's great. Where do you think Urlacher is going to go? Maybe a charter school of his own?
We have to make sure they understand that these are people.
Lord knows. I hope he lands on his feet. He's done well in Chicago.
There you go. But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, you look at the arguments for closing these schools, the underutilization.
More demand than anything to that? I mean, are we talking
about, you know?
We have to take a stand. We have to fight the same fight.
Well, let me give you some examples, and this is why teachers, need to take parents, and folks in the affected neighborhoods have such a problem because they announced, the board announces criteria about underutilization. We finally got them to admit, for example, that they did not take into account the large special education populations in many of these schools. They look at architectural drawings for these schools, count the number of classrooms, count the number of students. They say if you got between 30 and 36 kids in a class, you're rooms are efficiently used. They ignore, for example, that you cannot have 30 to 36 special education kids, autistic kids, other kids with severe disabilities in a class by law. But they ignore those populations in coming up with their numbers. So we were able to at least call them out on that and get them to acknowledge that it never entered their calculus for underutilization. There are a whole host of other issues with respect to their calculation that I don't want to bore your listeners with, because it's just real inside baseball stuff. But they essentially put these numbers out and force parents, teachers to fight and defend them. And it's pitting schools against schools. They hold hearings in neighborhoods where they've got kids who get 6 minutes each. Excuse me, schools that get 6 minutes each, putting kids up to talk about why their school should be saved. And then they move to the next school and another kid in tears. So it's like a, as one of my reporter friends in town called it, a Hunger Games mindset, pitting one school against another in the same hearings. And
I think that it's important to
distasteful, disgusting, and
that is not just blue collar workers.
Yeah, but I look at this and then you go, what should we be doing?
As soon as they have a
path, it's deplorable, it's despicable, what you've laid out.
Good wages, limiting good
paying jobs. What should we be doing? I look at this from
the
I do believe the end game is to do away with all the public education.
So absolutely, this is a fight that is not
just seems to be just that, a march towards the end.
Right, and what you got to remember in Chicago is that, you know, we sit here today, what is it, April 5th, 2013. If we go back to April 5th, 2008, 5 years, we are on our fifth CEO in the district in 5 years. So there's no continuity of leadership. Every new CEO brings and his or her new team of leaders.
Because,
the last couple of CEOs have been from out of state.
It's a hardship.
And so it takes them months to even figure out where the vending machines are. Well,
you know, we do
have downtown CPS offices, much less to understand what goes on and what has been going on in these neighborhoods. So, you know, the notion that our last two superintendents who come in from New York, and Barbara Burt Bennett by way of Cleveland and Detroit, where she was a prolific school closer, know anything about these neighborhoods is laughable.
Part of the labor
movement.
You know,
much
less what they know about
the
history of what Mr. Duncan and his colleagues did for years, closing schools over and over, opening charter schools next
to
these shuttered schools, declaring press release academic successes at some of these schools when it served their interests.
This idea that you need to have a little bit set aside.
Proved wrong that, in fact, a lot of these schools they claim are great PR victories are not.
Federal government.
It's a tough spot. They've got a lot of money. They've got a big army of
corporate
supporters, and we've got an uphill battle against an all-powerful mayor.
But, you know, I look at that, and I look at this, and I wonder how strike, and when, I hear a lot of organizing going on. You want to speak a little bit about the organizing that you see
how
the parents
we
and students
well,
and the
fact of the matter is that the
teachers' union, as you know, came to power in Chicago.
That's what we want.
Because of organizing at a grassroots level, school by school. And so,
all of our
you can talk to plenty of CTU folks out here, and they can explain to you far better than I what they did. But I think their strike and their togetherness
pressure
that demonstrates their successes.
And
what I'm seeing as
a
parent who's been involved in following these closing issues for years is that in the last couple of years, a lot more parents from neighborhoods that are unaffected by school closings are coming out, organizing, getting together, walking through schools, going out to these neighborhoods, taking reporters into these schools, using whatever talents they have
to help
demonstrate what a sham this policy
is. We hear a lot about what goes on.
Because this mayor and previous CEOs of the school system have so aggravated them with their dishonesty that they've just had.
Or is it because they realize that they're on the Shark Tank as well?
I rarely find that to be the case.
While they may not be flavor of the month today, they may be, and their local school could be closed.
That's certainly an issue for some of the folks.
I'm curious, in this situation,
there
seems
is
to be the sticking point? Or is this another one of these moments where a corporation has just decided, you know what, we're going to do the union avoidance thing, we're going to try and break the union. What do you say to the person who says this?
Unfortunately, I think it's more the latter than anything else. I mean, we don't think that we're just asking anything unreasonable at the bargaining table, and this is the strike.
Well, I think, you know, we're concluding as a society, certainly in these big cities, that the better course of action for dealing with poverty is to jail kids a few years down the road rather than to educate them when they're young. And
right now, eight locations,
not a healthy recipe for
that have contracts that expire without a negotiated solution. So this is a pattern.
If you were the
head guy there. You were the CEO of the school district. What would you take?
These are the consequences.
Well, I think one of the things we need to address is that
not only
third or fourth grader who's coming into school every day to a home where they're not getting meals, where they haven't had people reading to them since they've been out of the womb. Those kids are going to require some additional support. They're going to require some wraparound services that we're not real good at providing. And simply shuttering their schools, giving them an iPad, and promising them air conditioning is not going to do it. I mean, that's the kind of payoff perk that we're used to in Chicago politics.
The Obama administration, the first thing they should have done was pass the Employee Free Choice
Act,
maybe update our labor law a little bit. How much of it is that?
My own daughter.
How much of it is that these companies have been getting away with this stuff for so long?
Well, I think our schools are fairly good.
Standard operating
procedure. She asked for a little bit of extra help, a little extra tutoring in math, just because she was just feeling a little overwhelmed.
I think it's really the culture. I think it's almost accepted that this is what's going to happen. Even profitable, successful companies, corporations are going to sit down and try and squeeze anything they can out of the labor contract.
Yeah, and in Chicago, it's all set against the backdrop of generations of segregation.
Get as much profit
divided out of city.
The
you've got politicians over the years who come to power
what the public might perceive
by playing one group off against another. And a lot of those folks are still sitting in the city council in Chicago,
and they
know they don't need to be as
and you know, they're just another entry on these days. There's another entry on a sheet.
2013, the things they said that we were able to say in the 80s,
and you know,
smart
even
enough
even
not to say these days.
Bill Gates,
they're still able to play a lot of those same prejudices.
So you're here in D.C. A lot of people out here for this event. They occupy the DOE 2.0. Where do you think you see this going over the next couple of days?
And you wonder where the disconnect
is. People go home.
Why is it?
What are you hoping for?
To help.
Well, I was talking to some educators from Massachusetts last night.
And his wife.
After I got into town,
they're so bent on doing good.
One of the things I said to them was that we know the mayors in these big cities and the CEOs of the school systems talk regularly, trade notes, talk
about
the Broad Foundation talking points and the best
and
way to close
to
schools, you know, et cetera.
Yeah,
and so that we
now,
educators, educators, activists, parents,
DC,
in addition to,
for us to
talking via Facebook and Twitter, probably need to come up with a similar plan of action so that we are talking more regularly
as
a group
about
what's going on and strategies to deal with the issues that a lot of us are facing. These educators in Massachusetts, we're asking, what can we do to help you in Chicago with the school closings issue?
Well, what we can do is
let
the public waste know that
other than providing moral support or perhaps writing articles,
tired of the way they're treating communities,
educating other parents,
hurt these workers,
it's tough.
These workers.
It's the hard work of organizing, but you guys are doing great work out there. I understand.
Public health.
Former musician.
They pick up what
warmer. I'm still out there working cars.
Rapper.
Well,
you were on a truck.
I play old rock.
These
like
nasty things
in the taverns in Chicago,
and that we
but,
value these
from time to time. In fact, my two recorded
tunes
both involve Rahm Emanuel. I wrote one when he was running for office, and I wrote Sunday night recorded it Monday. It's all about school
closings.
They can
follow updates at Pub,
getting some play in Chicago radio.
We also have a Facebook page where they can show their support at Republic Services.
But I got to tell you, as a 48-year-old white lawyer, being a rapping lawyer, it's really a niche market,
contract locally.
So not much. You got a lot of
going to stand for this kind of behavior by the company.
And we will make sure we get those links out at thericksmithshow.com. All that stuff will be under Galen Monroe's name. Galen, I appreciate the time. I wish your workers and your members the best of luck. And if there's anything we can do,
Matt, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Pleasure, Rick. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back. Listen to this.
Nine times six, 54. Schools getting closed like never before. It's the most school closings in history, but it ain't no Scooby-Doo mystery. Gonna clear out the neighborhood, keep people moving out to Harvey and Maywood. Ripping out community anchors, push out the poor kids, bring on the bankers. Where was Rob when the deal got done?
Out skiing in the Utah sun.
These are your schools, Chicago, and it's time to stand up.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rahm has gone too far.
progressive poser, walking bulldozer, union busting, grade school closer, 9.5, landed a quick jab, south side, west side, it's a land grab, looking for a tax base, maybe a white face, all out crisis that he won't let go to waste, running schools with the help of the fat cats, treating poor kids like they were lab rats, these are your schools, Chicago, tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, wrong has gone too far.
Mad about the strike, so now he's striking back. Bully with a big stick, hitting the brown and black. Moving kids like Monopoly pieces. Same old games, class size increases. When you fight back, Rom's like a rich dad trying to buy you off a brand new iPad. Air conditioning for when you get hot. Got fingers crossed that you don't get shot. These are your schools, Chicago. Tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rom has gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rom has gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rom has gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back. Rama's gone too far. You've got to stay.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight. Again, we're going to be in the nation's capital in front of the Lyndon Baines Johnson U.S. Department of Education building for Occupy 2.0, Occupy the DOE 2.0. Going to be going through some of the emails, going to talk to some activist educators. That's the main focus for this evening. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind about the event, if you've missed any portion of our coverage yesterday, you can make sure you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Big job numbers out today. 88,000 jobs created. The unemployment rate goes down by one tenth of a percent there. What can you say? We've lost another 3,000 manufacturing jobs. We haven't kept up with expectations. We haven't kept up with the demographic shift. I don't know how unemployment goes down in a month when you have such paltry, pathetic job numbers like what we've seen. And to me, it highlights, again, the fact that we have done nothing. We have done absolutely nothing on the jobs front. We have done nothing to create jobs. We've done nothing to invest in our infrastructure. We've done nothing to invest in our education and healthcare and all of the things that we need to be doing. All I keep seeing are more cuts, more gutting, more punishing. And being out here in the nation's capital talking about education, really highlighting the fact that over the last four and a half years, what we've seen going on is an all-out assault on public workers. And again, another month where we lost more public sector workers. Mission accomplished, GOP. Mission accomplished, corporatists, as we move away from the public sector. And where? Well, nowhere, because the jobs aren't being created. And I was just watching something on TV last night while I was in the hotel room here of a rich guy talking about, well, we need to get government out of job creation. We need to get government out of the economy. And I'm going, well, you know what? I'm sorry, but this whole concept of the free market, it's not working. It's not. I'm sorry. The free enterprise system, while it may sound great on paper, it just not seem to be working. Because at the end of it, and you go back through time, and you know, I go back to the guy I met in Florida who worked in the aerospace industry for years. All of the things that came out of government spending, all of the things that came out of investment, all of the things that came out of our infrastructure, and all of the research and development that's, well, now being put under the private sector. Are they doing it? Well, you look at these paltry job numbers, the answer is a resounding no. Corporate profits, fantastic. Wall Street, fat and happy. CEO pay, perks, benefits, all that stuff, wonderful. You know what's not? Well, no job creation. 88,000 jobs in the month when they were expecting 190. Lost 3,000 manufacturing jobs. You know, I look at this and I keep asking the question, what's it going to take? Yet all we're being fed and being force-fed is more division, more divisiveness, more shiny stuff. We're still talking about the wine and spirit shops. We're still talking about the lottery. We're still talking about all of these things that aren't job creators, but they're ideological. And that's what's frustrating to me, and that's what's frustrating to a lot of the people that I've met recently here at this event that we're at in Washington, D.C., is we're frustrated. The real problems that are pressing, the real problems that our nation faces, we don't seem to be addressing. And to me, that's what should be angering, what should be taking people to the streets, which is why we came out to this event. And we hope that you've enjoyed it. Tonight we're going to be talking to folks, educators, parents, students, activists, because the mainstream media has really, and I guess you could take the cynical view that they're bought off. Part of me says they're just lazy, and there's the other part says maybe it's true. Maybe the cynical view is they're bought off. I mean, on the education front, you know, when was the last time the local public school advertised in the newspaper? When was the last time the local public school advertised on radio or television? When they buy ads promoting themselves? Let me think. Hold on. Never. They don't do that because they're there for the common good, not for the common, for the single-minded profit. But I see a lot of the profiteers. I see a lot of ads for that. Got a couple of emails last night from our coverage. Very positive. Look, you know, the one woman wrote, hey, I didn't realize that this was going on. Is this happening in my school? Because, you know, and she reiterated what I said yesterday, that we all think that it's just like when we went to school. Things don't change. The school's the school. It is what it is. And the more you look at it, the more you go, you know, our tax dollars are being spent to enrich these big corporations. And a lot of people, I don't think, get what's behind the local school. You think, well, you know, the local teacher makes up the test and gives it to the kids. It's not like that anymore. It's not like when I was a kid and the teacher would go down and mimeograph off a test. I mean, they don't even have mimeograph machines anymore, but they would go down and they'd photocopy the test right there, and they would grade it right there. That's not the way it is anymore. Now it's all, here's this big corporation who's come out with this book, probably printed in places like China. We've got a lot to do. And for me, the education, why this is so important and why this is so personal to me is because I don't know that you can have any type of functional democracy, or even the representative democracy that we have, without an active, informed, and engaged electorate, and one that's able to look at what's going on, analyze problems, and come to solutions. I worry I worry that we're moving towards the generation of button pushers who know which buttons to push but have no idea why. I fear that we've become a compliant society, one that's thrown our hands up and said, you know what, we can't solve our problems. I'm hopeful in the vein that, look, there are people out in the street here, hundreds of people here at the Department of Education in Washington, saying, you know what, we want a better future for our kids. We want a new direction. We don't want to be on the charter path. We don't want to be on the privatization path. We want to be on what's good for the country path. And it's an interesting thought. You know, on Monday this week, we were in Charleston, West Virginia. And see, these are the kind of things that have got to scare the planners. These are the things that have to scare the wealth class of this country, that there are people willing to take to the streets, that they've done a great job of separating us, of dividing us, of keeping us pitted against one another. But what we're seeing is that grassroots organizing. We're seeing that groundswell of something's not right. And while I've been talking about this education thing for years, while I've been talking about charter schools and this whole privatization of our education system, I think there are people who are coming around as well. And, you know, while the wealth class may have the money and may have the media structure, we have out-procreated them. There are more of us. And the more that we talk to our neighbors, the more we talk to our friends and our family, and the more we get involved in our local community and our schools, and the more we take part in each other's lives, the more I think we can change this country. It can be the country that we want. It can be the place that we want it to be. But, you know, I see what happened in West Virginia on Monday, and I'm in awe. Look, you had 7,000 miners taken to the streets saying, you know what, we're going to fight you. We're going to fight you on stealing our benefits. They're not used to that. They're used to imposing their will. They're used to getting their way, running companies into deep debt and then running them through bankruptcy. And I look at these miners, man, and, you know, if we allow that to happen to them, if we allow them to steal those health care benefits from those retirees, the most vulnerable, people have given 30, 40, 50 years. One guy met 50 years in the mines walking around with his oxygen tank. If we allow them to steal health care from folks like that, the most vulnerable, what does it say about us? What does it say about what we're willing to allow to happen? You know, for me, it's about taking care of the least among us. You know, you go back to that whole idea, wow, we're a Christian nation. Are we? When we're willing to allow the most vulnerable to be exploited, when we're allowing them to be pushed to the edges, I don't know. We're going to find out. And over the next couple of days, weeks, and months, we're really going to find out about what it is about us. So here for the next 2 hours, you're going to listen to some interviews, some conversations I'm going to have with activists, educators, teachers, students, folks from all across the country here at the Occupy, the DOE 2.0 from Washington, D.C. If you have any questions, any thoughts, anything on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I will answer all emails personally. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The union does not condone cheating by anyone. If it's our member, we don't condone it. Our profession should have high standards, and we do have high standards. And in fact, 99.99% of our educators were never even touched in Atlanta or named in a report.
Georgia Federation of Teachers President Verdelia Turner talking about the arrests of 35 Atlanta public school educators in a test cheating scandal.
Turner says the union blew the whistle on test cheating back in 2005, but was ignored.
In Atlanta in particular, our voices were not heard, and we were ignored.
Turner says not enough emphasis is placed on learning and teaching in our schools, while too much emphasis is placed on standardized tests. And Turner says when teachers have a voice in the classroom through their unions, public education results are often better. 45 years after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life fighting for the union rights of Memphis sanitation workers, those workers are once again fighting for their jobs against a privatization effort. Chad Johnson is executive director of AFSCME Local 1733 in Memphis. He says privatization will hurt public services and hurt these workers.
We're standing up for basic services for all citizens. We're standing up also that no matter what job you have, you should be paid a decent wage, decent benefits, and have decent working conditions. It's that simple. And that unfortunately, we have the powerful in Memphis have forgotten the lessons from 1968, and we're going to remind them. This is an effort to bust a union in what many call the heart and soul of the union movement, because what happened in 1968 was that rare, perfect example that civil rights are labor rights.
Hundreds of fast food workers in New York City walked off their jobs Thursday demanding higher wages and the right to form a union without intimidation. Chicago's Workers' Organizing Committee stands in solidarity with the New York City workers. The New York City fast food workers say they work for corporations that reap huge profits while the workers who make those profits possible struggle with wages they can't live on. More information on the New York City fast food workers movement is available at fastfoodforward.org. Utility workers in Glendale, California are asking for mediators to be brought in to help end a contract dispute with the city. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 18, were denied a request for mediators by the city, a decision that was agreed with by California's Public Employee Relations Board. The city argues that Glendale Water and Power workers applied too late for a mediator. The IBEW argues that the board didn't correctly interpret the law, so they filed a lawsuit with a Los Angeles Superior Court judge. Negotiations broke down over the city's final contract proposal, which would have workers take a pay cut of 1.75% if they choose not to pay more for retirement benefits.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We stand united, undivided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call. Our brothers and our sisters, and are you and I to win? You and I both know that we can't rely on it. The time is prime, planets align, ain't no mistaking. For union resurrection, the anger has awakened. The sleeping giant, come on, yeah, we can do it. We need to revive, react, and re-up the labor movement.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, shows.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Of course, this is a portion of our program. You can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. It's been 45 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And you go back and you think about why was he in Tennessee? What was he doing down there? Helping workers. That's what he was doing, which is why I find it really kind of ironic that here we are 45 years later still fighting the same fights that we've been fighting for, well, I guess generations now. And I've got Galen Monroe, Communications Director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Galen, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, no, thank you for having us on. It's always great to be on here.
You know, I look at this, you know, it's 45 years since the assassination. He was in Tennessee to support workers.
Right, sanitation strike,
and here
absolutely.
We are. Still fighting the same fight.
It's a travesty. 45 years later, here we are again, and we're battling these massive corporations like Republic Allied Waste. They're a billion-dollar company making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and yet they are still sitting down and trying to squeeze every penny they can in negotiations with our union members on the ground. And that leads us to our current issue, which is we have a number of workers out on strike in Youngstown, Ohio. They work at a Allied Waste location called Carbon Limestone Landfill, and they've been forced out to do a unfair labor practice strike because Republic is still pushing and trying to get concessions out of them at the table.
Concessions.
Concessions.
This is a
company making hundreds of millions of dollars every year, and these are workers that have experienced incredible pressure from the company, whether it's illegally changing their working conditions without bargaining, refusing to provide pertinent information at the bargaining table, just violations of federal labor law that are just violating their rights on the job every day. And this is not something that is unique. This is something that Republic has and Allied Ways has done in many, many locations across the country. This is a pattern. They are trying to enrich their shareholders at the expense of their labor force. And, you know, this is not an easy job. This is not a job that 95% of the people in the world want to do. This is a job that is absolutely a dangerous job.
When I was in college, I worked on the back of a Packer myself.
There you go.
This is not easy work.
It is not. In fact, it's the fourth most dangerous job in the country. They are twice as likely to be killed on the job as police officers, seven times more likely than firefighters, and yet we still have this company marginalizing exactly what they do, squeezing them for wages, squeezing them for concessions at the bargaining table, wanting them to give up things like their benefits when you have a job that they could suffer a serious injury at any time, any day on the truck. And yet they want to pull things like the great benefits that we fought to get for them, health care, pension, providing for their family is an important thing. What if they got injured long term? What if they're God forbid, killed? You know, we have to make sure that these workers' rights are protected. And so when they're attacking these workers in Youngstown, we've extended these picket lines from Youngstown to places in Illinois, in Indiana, and now we've actually done it in California, five locations in the East Bay area today. And we have hundreds of workers out on honoring these picket lines. And we need to send a message to them that when they attack one group of workers, just because it's in Youngstown, Ohio, they're not isolated there. They are attacking their entire union workforce that works at Republic or Allied Waste.
You know, I wish that mentality would equate into the labor force as a whole, because I do believe in that concept of solidarity, that an injury to one is truly an injury to all, and that we are all in this together. And I know those sound like cliches and they sound like, you know, just slogans, but I truly believe that. I think my listeners believe that as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if we cannot stand together, we are never going to be able to fight against these companies that have unlimited resources. You know, we have to make sure they understand that these are people with families, these are people that are trying to provide in a very tough economic climate right now, and the more concessions they demand of them, despite them making millions of dollars in profits, the more concessions they demand, the weaker our middle class gets. So we have to stop it now. We have to take a stand. We have to fight the same fight that Martin Luther King Jr. fought 45 years ago. We need to take up his flag. We need to continue this fight.
So let me ask you, Kaylee, you hear a lot of these companies and you see a lot of it in the news, you know, asking for concessions. And look, I understand when times are tough and companies are struggling, you do need to help.
Right.
You do need to make sure that, you know, things are going in the right direction. But, you know, as you point out, this is a very profitable company.
Extremely
profitable.
Have
they had, I mean, is there something they could point to in the past and say, you know, well we had a good year and that's not the history of our company?
No.
I mean, anything, the CEO's taking concessions?
No.
Are we seeing any of the perks being taken?
Not at all. In fact, this company, Allied Waste, was acquired by Republic. And Republic, by acquiring Allied Waste, and you don't acquire another company unless you're doing well, became the second largest waste company behind Waste Management, I believe, in the country. This is not a company that's suffering. I'm sure that everyone at the top is making plenty of money. It's only down at the worker level, the labor level, that they seem to be trying to make their bottom line fatter.
Well, that's just not the waste industry. That's every industry.
Right, it is.
And I guess the difference here is that these workers actually have the Teamsters to represent them, have a voice, and have the ability to come forward. And, you know, I was in West Virginia on Monday where the mine workers, you know, the retirees are getting their health care stolen.
Another dangerous job, absolutely.
Another extraordinarily dangerous job. And when I look at this, I go, you know, at some point, do we not get it as a working class that there's an assault on all of us?
Mm-hmm.
And while it's the mine workers on Monday and now the trash workers, eventually we're all going to be in this boat. And as the mine workers asked, are you next? And my point on this is I think we are all next.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of who are we going to let go first?
Right. I think that it's important to make the middle class understand that it's not just blue-collar workers that are at risk here. We're just the first domino. You know, and as soon as they have a path to eliminating our benefits, eliminating our good wages, eliminating good-paying jobs, there's nothing to stop them from going up the ladder and attacking white-collar jobs that aren't traditionally thought of to be in this situation. So, absolutely, this is a fight that is not, you know, limited to blue-collar workers and not limited to your traditional labor. People that would identify with labor. If you sit at a desk, your job could be just as easily at risk if this trend continues.
What's this mean to the families in Youngstown right now? Youngstown's the heart of this, and you do, as you've said, this is extended to other places. What's it mean to the families? Because, you know, as someone who's been on strike a couple of times in my life, it's a hardship on the family, and it's a hardship on the future of the family.
Right. Well, you know, we do have the strike fund. We are trying to help them in any way we can. And, you know, the old saying is that no one wins in a strike, and it's true. But we do have to stand up, and these men, brave men and women, are standing up for their rights. And they understand the risks they're taking. They understand what they're, but they do understand what they're standing up for. And as a lesson that, you know, you really have to learn if you're going to be part of the labor movement.
Well, you know, when I first started, you know, 20 some years ago as a Teamster, the old timer took me aside and said, look, kid, you better put some money away, have 6 months in the bank, because at any second you need to stand up and defend what it is we've fought for you to have.
Absolutely.
And that's something that I think has been forgotten the last generation. This idea that you need to have a little bit set aside for when tough times come. Mm-hmm. Not just personally, but you look at our state and federal government. I think they've forgotten that as well.
No, I agree. I agree completely. You have to save for a rainy day, as they say. And you know, the labor movement, that's always important.
You know, and I look at this, and you know, I wonder, how, you know, when is this going to come to Pennsylvania? Does it affect anyone in our state? And the other part of this is, how do we help?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the picket lines can be extended to anywhere across the country, and that's what we want this company to understand, is that this is not about only about Youngstown. It's about all of our members that work in this industry, that work at Republic, that work at Allied Waste, that we are going to extend these picket lines, and put pressure on the company to sit down at the negotiating table and come to a good agreement for these workers. This is what we did in 2012 with Mobile, Alabama. You know, we extended picket lines when we had issues with Republic Allied Waste there. And eventually it did work. This strategy did work. And so we are enacting the same strategy here. These workers are committed. They know what they have to do to make sure that they come out still standing tall at the end of this.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Galen Monroe, communications person with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. You know, we hear a lot about what goes on, and like you said, no one wins in a strike. But, you know, what's going on at the bargaining table sometimes is important, and what it's over. And I hear a lot of people talk about, well, you know when people go on strike, it's because they're greedy and they want money. I rarely find that to be the case. I generally find you're talking about safety, you're talking about health, you're talking about benefits, you're talking about future retiree benefits, things like that. I'm curious, in this situation, what seems to be the sticking point? Or is this another one of these moments where a corporation has just decided, you know what, we're gonna do the union avoidance thing, we're going to try and break the union and kick them out altogether?
Unfortunately, I think it's more the latter than anything else. I mean, we don't think that we're just asking for anything unreasonable at the bargaining table. And this strike isn't about, you know, negotiating per se. It's about the violations that the company have made to federal labor law, changing working conditions and not providing information key to negotiations. But this is a trend with this company. We have... right now, 8 locations, including Youngstown, that have contracts that have expired without a negotiated solution. So this is a pattern with this company, and we have to make sure that they understand this is what is going. These are the consequences of not sitting down and negotiating a fair contract. Not only Youngstown, but Evansville, Urbana, Memphis, Cleveland, Toledo, Atlanta, Pensacola. These are all locations that do not have a contract settled past their expiration date with this company. And so it's important that we take a stand and let them know that we're going to fight to make sure that these workers have the best representation and receive industry-leading contracts.
So let me ask you this, you know, and because I've often said our federal labor law is extremely broken, it's outdated. I thought the Obama administration, the first thing they should have done was pass the Employee Free Choice Act and maybe update our labor law a little bit. How much of it is that? How much it is that these companies have been getting away with this stuff for so long that it's just standard operating procedure, and how much of it is you know, maybe that it's just the culture?
I think it's really the culture, frankly. I think it's almost accepted that this is what's going to happen, is that even profitable, successful companies, corporations are going to sit down and try and squeeze anything they can out of the labor contract. They feel beholden to their shareholders. They feel that it's important to enact get as much profit out of the company as possible, regardless of what the public might perceive as squeezing labor, squeezing unions, because they feel that the mighty dollar rules everything, and people are not men and women; they're numbers.
They're numbers, right?
And you know, they're just another entry, right? They're just another entry on a sheet, and they just need to try and fatten up that bottom line somehow. And, you know, even with Republic, I mean, Bill Gates, a great philanthropist, I couldn't talk there, with his own foundation, I mean, he's one of the large shareholders in this company. And you wonder where the disconnect is. You know, why isn't he doing something to help these workers? You know, if he's so bent, and his wife is they're so bent on doing good, why does this exist here in this company that he is such a large shareholder in?
That's a good question. And, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, when you start talking about these large investors, it's about the bottom line.
Right. Absolutely.
And we need to change that culture.
Yeah, and all we can do is what we're doing now. I mean, of course, things have to happen here in Washington, D.C., for us to enact change. But until then, we need to fight on the ground as best we can.
Last question I have for you. How do we help? What does the average person do? Because, you know, it's my thought that, you know, as I'm thinking about this company, you know, a lot of what they get is through tax dollars. A lot of what they get is, you know, municipal contracts. What can we do to help?
Well, what we can do is let Republic Allied Waste know that we're fed up with what they're doing, that we're tired of the way they're treating communities when they hurt these workers, when they attack these workers. They're not only attacking the workers, they're attacking the community, because these workers are responsible to a certain degree in protecting public health. You know, they pick up what we don't want anymore. And who knows what's in those bags that they pick up? Who knows what they're – I mean, you were on a truck. I'm sure you've seen some some nasty things
absolutely.
In the past. And that we value these workers. We value what they do. They can go and they can get more information at our website for this issue. It's www.pickupthegarbage.com. They can follow updates at Repub Teamsters on Twitter. And we also have a Facebook page where they can show their support at Republic Services Teamsters. Any support they can show in the public will help us in the long run. Talk to the municipalities if they have a Republic or Allied Waste contract locally and tell them that they're not going to stand for this kind of behavior by the company.
And we will make sure we get those links out at thericksmithshow.com. All that stuff will be under Galen Monroe's name. Galen, I appreciate the time. I wish your workers and your members the best of luck. And if there's anything we can do, we're here for them.
Thank you, Rick. You're always great help.
Thanks so much, Galen Monroe, communications person for the International Brotherhood of the Teamsters. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
To the Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events. Access. Critical illness, disability, or death? No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Is America truly the land of the free? When working families have to struggle to survive, Are workers free to achieve the American dream?
The Teamsters Union is North America's strongest union. We fight for our 1.4 million members and all of America's working families. Teamsters are fighting for the rights of the middle class in Washington, in state capitals, in city councils, and most important, in the workplace. Join us in the fight to keep the American dream alive.
Connect with the Teamsters Union at Teamster.org, Facebook, and Twitter.
It's back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
I got 800 miles of open board.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you've missed any coverage of our coverage here at Occupy the DOE 2.0, just go to the website, thericksmithshow.com, or get the Stitcher app. Anything on your mind, questions, comments, email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. You know, I listened to that, you know, that conversation with Galen, and, you know, I remember back, you know, my years working on the back of a garbage truck, really very dangerous, very dirty, miserable, just hard work. And, you know, I remember back breaking, I was a young man at the time, I was, you know, 18, 20 years old, you know, working back there, just really very dangerous work, very heavy lifting, all of that. And, you know, you think about the kind of disrespect, you think about the kind of, well, the mentality that goes into saying, well, you know, we can pay you minimum wage, we can pay you next to nothing, we can get anyone like you to do this work. It really shows me just what corporate America thinks of us. And, you know, I was thinking about a couple of the people that I worked with over the years. One guy got hit by a car on the back of the Packer. And, you know, Galen hit on it. It's a very dangerous, very, very, very hard job. And you look at these employers, and it's not just the sanitation workers. You know, it's mine workers. It's construction workers. It's workers in general. And, you know, I go back to what, you know, the sign said at the mine workers rally. You know, are you next? You know, who's next in all of this? And I argue we all are. At some point, you know, we've got to say, you know, we're not going to take it anymore. And I look at this situation at Republic, and it seems it's always a constant fight. It's always a constant battle. And I guess, you know, that's how it's always been. Maybe for too long we thought, you know, things, you know, especially when unions were stronger, when you had 30-35% of the workforce as members, you know, we thought maybe, hey, we won. Not so much. And I look at, you know, 2008 when Obama won, and in 2009 when he took over, a lot of people looked at it, hey, we won. Well, you know, you see the news today? Chain CPI. What we were just talking about the other day, getting him to say he wasn't going to do, well, it looks like chain CPI is in the future of Social Security. And what's that going to mean? You know, it's not bad enough that we've got corporations who are trying to screw their workers. Now you've got our government, you know, doing the same thing. This chain CPI just, I mean, at every turn. At every turn, the attacks are there, and I know it's easy. I know it's easy to throw up your hands and say, you know what, we can't change it. I know it's easy to say, you know things are seem insurmountable. We can't change it. I think we can, which is why, you know, here at this event, the reason we came out here is to talk to the activists, talk to the educators, talk to people who are standing up and fighting back and saying, hey, come with us. Not follow me, but come with us. Stand together with us. All of us. And that's not just education. That's not just on the job. That's part of American life. That's part of what we should be doing as a nation, standing together. I wonder how much longer it's going to take. I'm encouraged. As I've said before, I'm encouraged by some of the things I've seen recently. I'm encouraged by the fact that you've had the 7,000 to 10,000 mine workers who took to the streets. I'm encouraged by the hundreds of people who showed up to this event. I'm encouraged by hearing the stories that we've brought you the last couple of hours, and the stories that we brought you yesterday of people in their communities all across the country who have stood up and said, you know what, we're going to do the hard work of organizing, not for a profit, not because there is something in it for us, but because it's right, because it's what's best for our country. You know, and you look at this and you go, at some point maybe we will win. But for me, it's about my kids. And a lot of these folks that I've met, it's about that next generation. It's about getting what we had. And I know it's easy to go, well, you know, nothing's changed. School's just what they were, you know. And it's easy to buy into the rhetoric because it's everywhere. Everywhere you turn. The schools are failing. You hear it all the time, but are they? What's the definition of failing? Are these insane test scores that we keep hearing about? You know, and the more I talk about these tests with experts, with people who, this is their life, the more I realize this is not the answer. And I remember when No Child Left Behind came out, I said, that was not the answer. And it amazes me. It amazes me that my most ardent anti-government people aren't fighting this the most. See, this is one of those bipartisan, nonpartisan issues that I think all of us can come together on. Tea Party, Republican, conservative, liberal, progressive, whatever. Whatever your label is, whatever motto, flag you crawl under, I think this is a uniting issue. And if we can and are willing to stand up and fight back. And look, on the state level, all the charter bills are there. On the state level, all of this stuff is right there. And you've got a good, most of the Republicans in favor of it, and a couple of Democrats who are in favor of more charterizing and more privatizing education. Something we need to be right now actively working to fight back on. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk with Chicago activist and parent Matt Farmer. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more are gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Together, power when we organize. Power.
it's cold. Go okay. outside all day. You ready? What are you playing?
Nothing yet.
All right. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. And, of course, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. It's been 45 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And you go back and you think about why was he in Tennessee? What was he doing down there? Helping workers. That's what he was doing, which is why I find it really kind of ironic that here we are 45 years later still fighting the same fights that we've been fighting for, well, I guess generations now. And I've got Galen Monroe, Communications Director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Galen, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, no, thank you for having us on. It's always great to be on here.
You know, I look at this, you know, it's 45 years since the assassination. He was in Tennessee to support workers.
Right, sanitation strike,
and
absolutely.
And here we are. Still fighting the same fight.
It's a travesty. 45 years later, here we are again, and we're battling these massive corporations like Republic Allied Waste. They're a $1 billion
of the working class majority.
And yet they're still trying to squeeze every kind of negotiations with our
Rick Smith Show. We are here in Washington, D.C.
That leads
to Occupy the DOE 2.0,
which is
talking to educators, activists, organizers, students, people from across the country have come out to support public education and to push back against the path that we're on. I'm sitting here with Matt Farmer, an attorney and a parent activist in the Chicago area. Matt, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, we've had you on the program a number of times. What brings you out here to D.C. from Chicago?
Concessions.
Well, I missed Arne Duncan. Our gift to the nation. I just wanted to come back and connect with Arne, talk hoops, which I think he knows a lot more about than he does education. I think if we could find a neutral third party site in another country to set him up for retirement, we'd all be best served on the education front.
And this is not something.
I look at this and I go, maybe that's not a bad idea because the destruction that he's done to education. And I do believe he's done some really some real damage to this country education-wise and to the future of our country.
Well, we're staying in a hotel right across the street from the Department of Education. And when I walked downstairs this morning, I saw a large contingent from FEMA in the hotel. And I'm hoping they are here to address the destruction that is the Department of Education.
Twice likely to be killed on the job.
There, but who knows?
But now in Chicago, I understand, 54 schools are closed?
54 schools are on the hit list, which is the largest school closing
wanting them
in United States history,
like
unprecedented.
And that's down from what, 120, 129, I think?
Serious injury at any time.
Well, we don't know what it's down from. The way this works in Chicago is the Board of Education at some point in time puts out a list of schools that meet the criteria for closing. And those criteria change from year to year. This year, it was about the so-called underutilization of schools rather than the academic performance of schools. So initially, we were told there were upwards of 300 schools in Chicago that met the criteria. There was a series of meetings around town and reports issued by a so-called independent commission, the chairman of whom has a charter school in Chicago named after him. The list of 300 schools was whittled down to, I think, initially 129, at which point the commission issued a report saying we recommend you can close comfortably 80 schools. The district then decided upon the magic number of 54. Interestingly, they did that on the same day that Bears linebacker Brian Urlacher, the number 54, was released by the Chicago Bears, so it may have just been a sick tribute to him to come up with that 54 number.
Do you think there's something there?
I'm not sure. I've got some people looking into it.
People are trying to provide in a very tough economic climate right now. And the more concessions they demand of them, despite...
That's great. Where do you think Urlacher is going to go? Maybe a charter school of his own?
The weaker our middle class.
Lord knows. I hope he lands on his feet. He's done well in Chicago.
There you go. But here's the thing. I mean, you look at the arguments for closing these schools underutilization.
You hear a lot of these companies.
Anything to that? I mean, are we talking talking sessions. About, and look, I understand what times.
Well,
are
let me give you some examples, and this is why
you do need to make
teachers,
sure that, you know, things are
parents and
are
folks in the affected
right
neighborhoods
yeah,
have such
a
problem
this
because
is a profitable company.
Extremely
have
profitable.
They have,
they announced,
I mean,
the board announces criteria about underutilization. We finally got them to admit, for example, that they did not take into account the large special education populations in many of these schools. They look at
this company
architectural drawings for these schools, count the number of classrooms, count the number of students. They say if you got between 30 and 36 kids in a class, your rooms are efficiently used.
In the country.
They ignore, for example, that you cannot have 30 to 36 special education kids, autistic kids, other kids with severe disabilities in a class by law. But they ignore those populations
and
coming up with their numbers. So we were able to at least call them out on that and get them to acknowledge that it never entered their calculus for underutilization. There are a whole host of other issues with respect to their calculation that are
dangerous.
I don't want to bore your listeners with because it's just real inside baseball stuff. But they essentially put these numbers out and force parents, teachers to fight and defend them. And it's pitting schools against schools. They hold hearings in neighborhoods where they've got kids who get 6 minutes each. Schools that get 6 minutes each, putting kids up to talk about why their school should be saved.
It's important,
and then they move to the next school, and another kid in two.
That
so it's like a, as one of my reporter friends in town called it, a Hunger Games mindset, pitting one school against another in the same hearings. And it's just distasteful, disgusting, and wrong.
Yeah, but I look at this, and then you go, what should we be doing? I mean,
so absolutely, this
it's
is
deplorable,
this is
it's despicable.
Is
what you've laid out.
To
what should we be
not limited to?
Well,
because
I
look at this from the
labor.
I do believe the end game is to do away with all the public education.
The desk,
so all of this incremental movement towards
if
that
trend
just seems to me just that the march towards the end.
Right, and what you got to remember in Chicago is that we sit here today. What is it, April 5th, 2013? If we go back to April 5th, 2008.
It's a hardship on the CEO
in the district.
Well, we do have to strike.
So there's no continuity of leadership. Every new CEO brings in his or her new team of leaders. The last couple of CEOs have been from out of state. And so it takes them months to even figure out where the vending machines are in the downtown CPS offices, much less to understand what goes on and what has been going on in these neighborhoods. So, the notion that our last two superintendents have come in from New York.
Barbara
Burke Bennett by way of Cleveland
to
Detroit, where she was
a
school closer.
The bank
know anything about these neighborhoods
is
laughable.
For you to have.
Much less what they know about the history of what Mr. Duncan and his colleagues did for years, closing schools over and over, opening charter schools next to these shuttered schools, declaring press release academic successes at some of these schools when it served their interests.
And, the labor movement, that's always
proved wrong that, in fact, a lot of these schools that claim are great PR victories
are
not.
When is this going to come to Pennsylvania?
So
it's
a tough spot. They've got a lot of money. They've got a big army of corporate supporters.
The fact of the matter is that
battle against
the picket lines will be extended.
But, I look at last year,
that's just what we want.
This
company understands.
I hear a lot of organizing going on. Can you speak a little bit about the organizing that you see at parents and students
that work at Republic, that work at Allied Ways?
And the teachers union as well in Chicago?
Well, the teachers union, as you know, came to power in Chicago
put pressure
because
on
of organizing
at
a grassroots level
and
school
come
by
to a
school.
Good agreement for
you know, you can talk to plenty of CTE folks out here and they can explain to you far better than I what they did, but I think their strike and their togetherness during that demonstrates their successes. What I'm seeing is a parent who's been involved in following these closing issues for years is that in the last couple of years,
there's another Rich Mitchell, Galen Monroe, communications person.
That are unaffected by school closings.
We hear a lot about what goes on.
Organizing, getting together, walking through schools, going out to these neighborhoods, taking reporters into these schools, using whatever talents they have to help demonstrate what a sham this policy is. And I think they're doing it because this mayor and the previous CEOs of the school system have so aggravated them.
retirees, things like that. I'm curious, in this situation, is it because they realize that they're in the shark tank as well, while they may not be flavor of the month today, they may be, and their local school could be closed down.
That's certainly an issue for some of the folks, but you know, I just think there is a profound distrust for the folks who are saying about the violations that the company has made, federal labor law.
What do you say to the person who says this is just an urban problem, a Chicago problem?
But this is a trend with this company. We have
well, I think, concluding as a society, that has big cities that there's a better course of action for dealing with poverty is
to
jail kids a few years down the road rather than to educate them when they're young. And
not it's sitting down and
not a healthy recipe for
not only Youngstown, but Evansville, Savannah, Memphis, Cleveland, Toledo, Atlanta, Pensacola. These are all locations that do not have a contract set up past their expiration.
Well, I think one of the things we need to address is that a third or fourth grader who's coming into school every day from a home where they're not eating meals, where they haven't had people reading to them since they've been out of the womb. Those kids are going to require some additional supports. They're going to require some wraparound services that we're not real good at providing.
In
simply shuttering their schools, giving them an iPad, and promising them air conditioning is not going to do it. I mean, that's the kind of payoff perk that we're used to in Chicago politics.
And how much of it is maybe helping kids? Yeah, doing that hard work of extra tutoring time, extra
opportunities.
My own daughter, as a parent, I look at my own daughter in a local public school.
I think our schools are
even fairly good.
Profitable,
she asked for a little bit of extra help, a little extra tutoring
and
math, just because she was feeling a little overwhelmed. And while they said, okay, you can come once or twice,
they feel beholden to their shareholders. They feel that it's important to get as much profit out of the company as possible, regardless of what the public might perceive as squeezing.
And in Chicago, it's all set against the backdrop of generations of segregation.
People are not.
You've got a divided city. You've got politicians over the years.
And
they're
just another entry
by playing one group off against another. And a lot of those folks are still sitting in the city council
in Chicago,
and they know they don't need to be as
philanthropist
forward. You know, they're communists these days.
His own foundation.
2013, the things they said were able to say in the 80s, they're smart enough not to say.
And you wonder where the
they're still able to play a lot of those same prejudices to their advantage.
So you're here in D.C., and you know a lot of people out here for this event. They occupy the DOE 2.0. Where do you think you see this going over the next couple of days? And once this breaks and people go home, what are you hoping for?
Well, I was talking to some educators from Massachusetts last night after I got into town.
And we need to change that culture.
One of the things I said to them was that we know the mayors of these big cities and the CEOs of the school systems talk regularly, trade notes, talk about Broad Foundation talking points and the best way to close schools, et cetera. And so that we educators, educators, activists, parents, in addition to talking via Facebook and Twitter, probably need to come up with a similar plan of action so that we are talking more regularly.
Well, what we can do is
as a group
public
about what's going on and strategies to deal with the issues that a lot of us are facing. These educators in Massachusetts were asking, what can we do to help you in Chicago with the school closings issue?
Because these workers are responsible for
a tricky question
and protecting
because,
public health.
Other than providing moral support or perhaps writing articles,
who knows what's in those
speaking out,
who knows what's
educating other parents.
I'm sure you've seen some some nasty things.
It's the hard work of organizing.
And that
but
we
you guys
value
are doing
these
some great work out there. I understand you're a former musician.
They can go and they can
former. I'm still out there
musician.
Working the bars.
Rapper.
For this
well,
I
play old rock and roll, play guitar and sing.
They can follow updates
in Chicago.
At Repub.
From time to time. And in fact,
and we
my
also
two recorded rap tunes
both
involve Rahm Emanuel. I wrote one when he was running for office, and I wrote one
any support they can
Sunday
show
night, recorded it Monday. It's all about school closings.
Talk to
and
municipalities if they
been,
have
getting some play in Chicago radio and getting some
they're
news coverage, so
kind of
we'll see where it goes. But I got to tell you, as a 48-year-old white lawyer, being a rapping lawyer, it's really a niche market.
Your workers
so,
and your members the best of luck. So not much, you got a lot of room for growth, though. I mean, there's not much competition, a lot of room.
Thanks so much, Kaylin Moreau,
communications
person.
Yeah, I don't see it as a growth industry, though, for all you youngsters out there.
We're going to play Matt Farmer's rap song, the 48-year-old rapper. Matt, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Pleasure, Rick. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back. Listen to this.
6, 54. Schools getting closed like never before. It's the most school closings in history, but it ain't no Scooby-Doo mystery. Gonna clear out the neighborhood, keep people moving out to Harvey and Maywood. Ripping out community anchors, push out the poor kids, bring on the bankers. Where was Rob when the deal got done? Out skiing in the Utah sun. These are your schools, Chicago, and it's time to stand up.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rob has gone too far.
Progressive poser, walking bulldozer, union busting, grade school closer, 9.5, landed a quick jab, south side, west side, it's a land grab, looking for a tax base, maybe a white face, all out crisis that he won't let go to waste, running schools with the help of the fat cats, treating poor kids like they were lab rats. These are your schools, Chicago, tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rahm has gone too far.
Mad about the strike, so now he's striking back. Bully with a big stick, hitting the brown and black. Moving kids like Monopoly pieces. Same old games, class size increases. When you fight back, Rahm's like a rich dad, trying to buy you off with a brand new iPad. Air conditioning for when you get hot. Got his fingers crossed that you don't get shot. These are your schools, Chicago. Tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rahm has gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rahm has gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rahm has gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rahm has gone too far. You got to stand up.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The union does not condone cheating by anyone. If it's our member, we don't condone it. Our profession should have high standards, and we do have high standards. And in fact, 99.99% of our educators were never even touched in Atlanta or named in a report.
Georgia Federation of Teachers President Verdelia Turner talking about the arrests of 35 Atlanta public school educators in a test cheating scandal. Turner says the union blew the whistle on test cheating back in 2005. But was ignored.
In Atlanta in particular, our voices were not heard, and we were ignored.
Turner says not enough emphasis is placed on learning and teaching in our schools, while too much emphasis is placed on standardized tests. And Turner says when teachers have a voice in the classroom through their unions, public education results are often better. 45 years after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life fighting for the union rights of Memphis sanitation workers, those workers are once again fighting for their jobs against a privatization effort. Chad Johnson is executive director of AFSCME Local 1733 in Memphis. He says privatization will hurt public services and hurt these workers.
We're standing up for basic services for all citizens. We're standing up also that no matter what job you have, you should be paid a decent wage, decent benefits, and have decent working conditions. It's that simple. And that unfortunately, we have the powerful in Memphis have forgotten the lessons from 1968. And we're going to remind them. This is an effort to bust a union in what many call the heart and soul of the union movement, because what happened in 1968 was that rare, perfect example that civil rights are labor rights.
Hundreds of fast food workers in New York City walked off their jobs Thursday demanding higher wages and the right to form a union without intimidation. Chicago's Workers Organizing Committee stands in solidarity with the New York City workers. The New York City fast food workers say they work for corporations that reap huge profits while the workers who make those profits possible struggle with wages they can't live on. More information on the New York City fast food workers movement is available at fastfoodforward.org. Utility workers in Glendale, California are asking for mediators to be brought in to help end a contract dispute with the city. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 18, were denied a request for mediators by the city, a decision that was agreed with by California's Public Employee Relations Board. The city argues that Glendale Water and Power workers applied too late for a mediator. The IBEW argues that the board didn't correctly interpret the law, so they filed a lawsuit with a Los Angeles Superior Court judge. Negotiations broke down over the city's final contract proposal, which would have workers take a pay cut of 1.75% if they choose not to pay more for retirement benefits.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. We're in Washington, D.C., the Occupy, the DOE 2.0. Beautiful day here, talking about education, talking with educators, parents, teachers, activists from across the country. I've got Michelle Enser. She's an educator from New York here sitting with me, a first grade teacher, as I understand. Michelle, thanks for taking time for me.
Absolutely, not a problem.
What brought you to Washington today?
Well, a lot of things. Literally my car.
The bus, right?
No, my car. Mainly the reliance on testing, high-stakes testing. I won't even call them standardized testing because the tests are not even standardized, so that's another lie. One of the things that really brought me was the big lie that these tests, these high-stake tests, are helping me somehow inform my instruction, which they do not.
So you're a first-grade teacher.
Yes.
And this is what kind of got me just stumped. You know, when I was in kindergarten and first grade, you know, half of the thing was just, could you sit in the seat long enough not to wet yourself, and could you tie your shoes?
Absolutely.
So explain to me how it is that we can standardize test that.
Well, conveniently,
I understand they're doing an awful lot more than they did when I was in kindergarten.
Yes.
But I don't see how these standardized tests can possibly be given to kids at that age.
Well, the good news is we do it on the computer, so it's fun. So we take you to the computer lab.
That's not true because, you know, my son who, you know, before he got to kindergarten was reading at a third grade level.
Right.
Hates reading on the computer.
Sure.
Has to hold a book in his hand.
Absolutely.
So have I done a disservice to him by giving him a book and not a tablet?
No, not at all. He should have every book he ever wants to read ever, no matter if it's fiction or nonfiction or whatever.
Because he hates doing that. I think it's Study Island or whatever.
Oh,
Whatever the thing is where you got to read on the online and take the test.
Yeah, yeah.
Hates that.
Yeah. We do, in my district, we do the STAR test, which is a 30-question test, which also times the kids out. So if you're a slow reader, a thorough reader, you get timed out and you can't answer the question, so we don't even know what you know. Then it spits out for me a lovely little, it's red if you're really in need of intervention, then there's yellow, then blue, then green. Green
are the good.
Absolutely, it's so pretty.
Because you're not educated enough.
Because in the first week of school, had no clue who could read and who couldn't. Right, exactly.
So how much of this do you think is really destroying the profession of teaching and really the art of teaching and making it much like factory work?
Exactly. It is exactly. And in fact, in New York, on engageny.org is the website, they are creating modules of instruction which are totally scripted. So really, you don't need to be a teacher to follow the script. You could probably be an actor and play a teacher in the classroom.
You could do like when I call, to ask for help from any various company who has shipped their call center over to India.
Absolutely.
And they have a flow chart. We could do that with education.
Absolutely. That's the intention. If you look at the modules, that's absolutely the intention, where it says T, how long is the string? S, 4 centimeters. T, good job. I honestly did not get a master's degree to have a script tell me that. Yeah, that's what's going on in New York.
And the sad thing is, though,
it's going on everywhere.
Michelle, it's going on everywhere.
Yes.
I mean, this is a national.
Yes.
And I know it sounds, some people say, well, you're being conspiratorial, but what is what I'm seeing and the people that we've talked to here the last day and a half. It's painfully apparent to me, and I'm sure all of my listeners, that this is a concerted effort by the very wealthy in this country to control what our kids see, hear, and read, and what they think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. New York State has a list of the recommended texts. Eighth graders will be reading To Kill a Mockingbird. First grade, I honestly haven't even looked at it because I figure 25 years master's degree, I kind of know what they should read.
Right.
We'll see when my evaluation comes about if I'm good enough or not.
Well, I mean, we should read, you know, in first grade, you should read what you can.
You should read what you can.
And what you're interested in.
And what you want.
I think you want to foster that love of, and that, of more than just, you know, regurgitation, but of exploration.
Absolutely. And the whole idea that we're going to have more rigorous texts is ridiculous. Some kids are just not developmentally ready to read in first grade, period. It doesn't matter. I can shove whatever I want in front of them. If they're not ready, they're not ready, right. And we need to respect that as well.
And if they didn't have the opportunity to have a decent pre-K program,
right,
or a decent kindergarten program. Like in Pennsylvania, for instance, I don't know how it is in New York, but in Pennsylvania, kindergarten isn't mandatory. In fact,
right,
the Harrisburg School District had actually considered in the public schools doing away with kindergarten because they couldn't afford the transportation.
Right.
But in Pennsylvania, the charter schools who offered it, the local school had to pay for transportation for them,
right,
to get to kindergarten.
Yeah.
You figure that one out, because I,
yeah,
still can.
Well, follow the money. That's the easiest way to figure it all out, is to follow the money. And in New York, it's follow the Pearson money back to Cuomo, who wants to be president. And that's pretty clear.
And to Bloomberg and to all of
them. And all
the
rest of them.
You come to Pennsylvania, you go to Corbett, you go to,
right,
Wisconsin, you go to Walker, you go to Perry, you go to all. This knows no political bounds.
No, and it really knows no political lines. I mean, this is certainly a bipartisan thing that people, it doesn't matter what you go in and what lever you pull. This is, honestly, race to the top is an end around the Constitution, which says every state will design its own education program. There is not to be a national curriculum. Well, if it's the Common Core state standards adopted by 46 governors, what is it? It's all but however many, 46, 52, I only teach first grade, so I don't know. Is it six?
Yeah.
All but six states have adopted this curriculum. So really, this whole thing is an end around that, and it's coming from Arne Duncan, who never taught a day in his life, who is, you know, the Michelle Rhee cheerleader. It's coming from people who have no clue what is a real education and what really teachers do.
So what is it that you do?
I teach. Well, first of
so
all,
because you know, I've talked to a lot of educators here. I've talked to a lot of parents, you know, and the one thing that we're being forced on, the reason they're here at the Department of Education building here in D.C. is to make them aware that, hey, there are other voices than what you're hearing. Because what I'm told is these folks aren't talking to teachers.
No.
They're talking to these people who are in these belief tanks,
yes,
that have made this stuff up over years. This isn't new. This is, you know, 30 years in the making.
Right, right.
But they have their agenda.
Well, sure, their agenda is to
make
sure
everybody... standing in the way.
Well, yeah. Heaven forbid. Yes, I am standing in the way, because another thing in New York State that we do is our schedules are all uploaded to the state, which is the whole other data collection thing. My grades are all uploaded. But in my schedule, there is no state code for playtime. So I have a schedule that says my kids never play, although, you know, I close the door and they play.
No,
yes,
we can't play.
Well, you know,
you can't play.
Forbid.
You got to get ready for work.
Well,
see, we need to do like we did in the good old days of the 80s and 90s, the 1880s and 1890s.
Yeah, exactly.
Put those kids in the mines and in the factories.
Right.
Put them. They got small hands. They can do intricate work.
Well, not only that, if they're doing field test questions, they basically are already doing child labor. So that's another whole issue. They're doing child labor for profit for Pearson or whatever testing company is testing out their field test questions on them. So now you've got your kids doing child labor. Without really you probably knowing it.
Yeah,
do you know if they're taking a field test or not? Does your school tell you? They should.
That's
they should
question.
Tell you when they're taking any sort of assessment.
I mean, they just did the PSSAs or whatever they
right.
were. And my daughter was a wreck.
Yeah. Well, yeah, probably. They're high stakes. They're
but
not standardized, but they're high stakes.
And like I tried to tell her, I go, it doesn't mean that you're going to fail or, you know, it's just another test.
It's way more than that. It I don't know what's going on in Pennsylvania. In New York, it could mean that your teacher gets fired. It could mean that you sit in, if you're a seventh grader and you don't get to go to band because you scored too low on the test, now you're sitting in an AIS class, Academic Intervention Services.
Yeah, she's only in fifth grade, so
my thought
had been, and I didn't do it, and I wish I would have at this point. I was going to tell her just to circle A.
The best thing to do is push it back and say, no, I won't do it. Which is, you know, what
which
teachers
what,
need to do, which is what the Seattle teachers did.
Yeah.
You know,
Garfield
which is,
High School
absolutely.
Up there, up there in
absolutely.
Washington. Yeah.
And it would be helpful in New York if we had a union that would support us. But when NICET says stay away from opt out, well, all the more reason to get my butt to D.C.
How much of that is, you know, the union not wanting to support it, and the other part of not wanting teachers to get fired? Because, you know, I look at this and I talk to a lot of teachers who are just, you know, they're scared that, you know, they're going to be out on an island and they're going to be, you know, you're going to get the district going after them. You're going to get all for standing up for their kids.
Well, in New York with a union, they could bring the 3020A against me. I don't know what their charge would be. The charge might be what? I didn't give a stupid test. I don't know. I gave parents good advice. The fine line is when you're in, you know, telling the parents of in your classroom. But meanwhile, I can go off to Buffalo and tell all the parents there what I think.
Okay.
So that's sort of the fine line right now, is telling parents of my students something that supposedly could hurt our school, although it never will, at least for the next 3 years. The waiver says it won't.
But isn't the argument that these tests are going to eventually kill all the schools? Because there's just no way you're going to have 100% proficiency.
Right.
There's just
absolutely
no way.
And where I am in I'm south of Buffalo, so I work in a school that's pre-K through 12. We have 320 kids, public school. And the commissioner has as much, Commissioner King has as much said to our principal. Their plan for small rural schools in New York is watch you fail, and then we'll pick up the pieces later.
And consolidate.
We hope. We don't know what they're going to do.
Well, I mean, they're going to shut down the local public schools.
Or they're going to
consolidate them in the education parks where you can have economy of scale, like a good business should do, right?
But, see, kids aren't a business. Kids aren't a widget.
Teacher talk.
But I don't make every kid the same. Kids aren't standard. If they were, how boring would life be? You and I would be exactly the same if people were standard, and we're not.
And what's wrong with that? I'm perfect.
Well, so am I, but you see... Therein lies the rub. So.
Yeah, I'm being facetious.
I know.
But, I mean, the sad reality is that there are some folks who think that way. That, you know, we want to have everybody, you know, cookie cuttered out, and that there should be these, you know, these standards that, you know, this baseline everybody should be at. Which, you know, part of me agrees. We should have a bottom line where everyone has the same basic skills, but not to the.
Right. There's a difference between having high standards for kids and having a test that's testing that standard that may not be at their developmental level. The next question I would ask is, where do Andrew Cuomo's kids go to school? Where do Arne Duncan's kids go to school? Where do the president's kids go to school? Not in a school like I teach in.
Yeah.
They go to a school where there are field trips, where there's every imaginable elective, and there are no high-stakes tests. So the problem becomes, it's good enough for everybody else, but not good enough for my kids.
So as the guy said yesterday, what we're creating is a caste system.
Absolutely.
So the very wealthy and those who can afford the smaller class sizes, all the experiential stuff, all of that, they're going to get that in. Well, the rest of us, we're just going to be worker bees anyway, right?
Right, right. Well, and I think Diane Ravitch, who said it, the Walmartization of education, that's what it is. We're going to teach you all how to work at Walmart.
The woman from Florida I talked to yesterday said that they actually put charter schools in an old Target building. And I said, you know, that's probably not a bad idea, since those are the jobs you're going to end up
right.
with. Maybe we should make McDonald's a charter school.
Hey, because, you know, that's... On-the-job training.
Because, I make light of this for the reason that what we've turned education into is this, well, it's how you're going to get a job. It's not about critical thinking citizens. It's about, this is how you're going to get a job.
But the reality is, the jobs that kids, that college graduates are getting, they need to think critically, they need to be creative, they need to collaborate.
No, they need to follow orders.
No, well,
do what they're told.
If
show
they
up
want
on time.
A career, those are the things they need to do. So we're taking all of that away from them, and then we ship them off to college where they're expected to do all this, and they can't. And, oh, lo and behold, our schools are failing because kids can't do it when they get to college.
That's okay. You know what we've done to college? We've put everything online. Everything's going to be in a for-profit college. So you can do it online. You can have your computer screen there. You can have your cheater screen there.
What about,
and then we're going to do the same thing to K through 12.
Well, yes,
and
we
then,
are.
Then you can take out huge, massive loans. Because right now college students are, you know, they're saddled with about $1 trillion in debt.
Yep.
Just think of the debt market we can have when those kindergartners need loans. Because they've got longer time to pay them off, right?
Right, right. You're
so
right.
This is the business model. And again, yes. It may sound like I'm being ridiculous, but the sad reality is I think there are people working on this stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because especially think about, again, like I said, a rural school. Is it easier to consolidate us, or is it easier to say you're all going online? I don't know.
It's cheaper to put them online.
Well, if you have any sort of internet connectivity in your little rural town. We'll put you on dial-up, I guess.
Well, I know.
Take a year and a half to get through kindergarten and dial-up.
Well, I mean, you know, in Philadelphia, for instance, they had this cyber charter school, yep. The Frontier Virtual Cyber Charter School, who had, I think, like 54 kids, and they promised them computers and internet access and printers and all this stuff, and none of them ever really got that stuff.
No.
And it didn't matter, because all it was about was collecting the money.
Right.
That's what was important. Whether those kids got educations or not, that had nothing to do with it. It was about the cash coming into the corporate form.
Right. Right, because education is the next big entrepreneurial area.
And then you know what happens in that scenario? Then you have all those 54 kids who didn't get that education. You know what they become then? Commodities for prison.
Right.
Another good growth industry.
Well, and we have for-profit prisons. So
see?
So
you're just not on board.
I guess I'm not. I'll be the rebel. I'll be the rebel with a cause.
So what do we do? Because as a parent, I want what's best for my kids. I want what's best for their friends and the next generation of our country. What should we be doing?
Opt out of the tests, for one. It's an easy. Well,
stop giving them the ammunition and the fodder. Destroy.
Right, because as Tim Slecker has said, if the data, this whole house of cards is built on data, and if we take away the data, the house of cards falls down. So the biggest thing that I think could have the most impact quickly is massive amounts of parents opting out because they don't have the data. The other thing you can do is write to your board of education, write to your superintendent, write to your principal, start speaking at board meetings, come to things like this, organize a meeting in your home of other parents who are concerned and spread information. That's what happened in Buffalo, and now Buffalo is exploding. In New York, we can't opt out. We have to refuse, or the children have to refuse, and just suddenly there's hundreds of parents in Buffalo who are, their kids are going to refuse the test, and we'll see what happens. I mean,
and I think what would scare those at the top or looking down from their ivory towers is once you start giving people that kind of empowerment, what does that build?
Right.
I mean, you know, to me, it's all about getting active, informed, engaged folks who are going to be empowered in their local communities to do what's right for their local communities.
Which is where education should rest. The education of a community's children should rest. Those decisions should rest with the community. That's why you elect a school board. Meanwhile, our school boards are just becoming...
Well, our school boards are solely so that we don't raise taxes on businesses.
Well...
Because most school boards are run by local business people who, I don't care what they do with education, we're just not raising taxes.
Right. Well, yeah, the no raise the tax line. Well, which we have in New York.
Yeah.
2% tax cap. So, you further burden those rural communities or those communities that have a lot of people in poverty. So, although in rural communities, in the town where I live, we will tax ourselves to no end. We will overtax ourselves to keep our school. That's how much we love our school.
As the state walks away from it.
Right.
As the federal government walks away from it.
Wait till you fail, and then we'll pick up the pieces. So.
Sad, sad stuff. Michelle Ensor, I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I hope you enjoy your weekend here.
And
go back into your community and keep up the fight.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has you with the opportunity
to let your kid, but what kind of response have you gotten? I can imagine you probably got some very positive responses and some blowback.
What's interesting is that it came out on Easter Sunday, and my 9-year-old son is really into statistics and numbers. That's sort of his thing. And so he would refresh the browser every few minutes, and he'd be like, Mom, we have 500 shares. And then he'd be like, we have 1,000 shares. And he's like, Mom, we have 1,200 shares. You know, he was counting it. It's now at over 40,000 likes and shares from that original piece. And what's so fascinating is I would say the positive to negative is about 10 to 1. The positive has been overwhelming. People say, amen. They say, sing it, sister. You know, every once in a while somebody says, what about the SATs? What about college?
Well, the SAT is, I mean, you're 18 years old. I mean, we're talking about 7, 8-year-olds, not 18-year-olds.
Some people say, you're coddling your son. He has to wake up to the real world. And I think,
oh, the tough world.
Really? He's 9 years old.
No, no. We need to go back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, the 1880s and 1990s. Put those kids back in the factories.
But aren't these the same people who say, why aren't kids playing outside?
Yeah.
Why aren't kids playing ball in the street? Well, I'll tell you, they're slogging over their homework inside. So, you know, I see this as a return to joy, creativity, intuition, to childhood. That's what this is about for me.
Yeah, because I got to be honest, you know, I'm 45. I don't remember these high-stakes tests. We took the Iowa Basic Tests of Skills or whatever they called it at the time. It was an hour here or there, and do your best, do what you can do. These are very different. This is a very different animal.
Yeah. Well, and this is what it's about. If this was just about Jacob, I don't honestly know if I'd be making this decision. But should a 9-year-old bear the burden of whether or not his school will move forward in what Karen Lewis has just called the game? What story do the winners tell the losers to keep playing the game? Should my 9-year-old child be shouldered with the burden of whether or not his teacher will be promoted, his teacher will get a performance bonus? To me, that is too much pressure to put on our children.
And I guess the other part of this that I think of is, you know, we seem to have this idea that, you know, children are like just empty vessels that we, you know, we pour this information into, kind of like an assembly line. And I've likened it to factory work. We think all the kids are like a piece of sheet metal that we can stamp into the identical thing, and they're going to all learn at the same pace, and they're all going to have the same understanding of the same things.
Well, that's right. And what I've seen is an almost immediate turnaround. I pulled back sort of the pressure on the homework. I started saying, if you finish it, you finish it, no big deal. But I started saying, let's read for pleasure for 20 minutes a day. I'll read to you. You can read on your own. 2 days ago, my son got off the bus. He was about a quarter mile from our house, and he was reading Harry Potter as he walked off the bus, and he read Harry Potter all the way home from school. This is a radical transformation, my kid, in the 6 weeks since I made this decision.
Yeah, I mean, I've told my daughter a number of times, she's in fifth grade, that, you know, I don't care if you know the answer, if you can regurgitate it to me, but I want you to be able to find it. I want you to know how to find the answer, how to get the information that you need. You may not have it at the tip of your fingers, but you need to know how to get it. And that's a huge difference between what I think educationally we're moving towards and where I think we should be going.
I think that's a really good point. I was trying to figure out if this 1972 silver dollar that I had was worth any value, and we needed to see something very small on the coin. And my son said, well, Mom, just download the magnifying glass onto your phone, the magnifying glass app. And I said, oh, you think there is such a thing? And I looked, and of course there was a magnifying glass app, and I downloaded it. Like, this is a kid who was born into this world. He understands how it works. What test past could show the ingenuity and creativity that he showed in that moment.
That's an excellent point. I mean, you know, my wife and I are, you know, technologically challenged. And, you know, we gave my 10-year-old a phone, a cell phone, because, you know, like I mean, we're probably late into this game, but, you know, because this is her world. This is the world the kids are going to have. We can't saddle them with our fear and misunderstanding.
With our limitations.
Exactly. And that's what part of me wonders if what we're doing with education as well.
I think that's a really good question. I think Jacob has so much more to learn and so much more to show than is measured by these tests.
So if the argument is we want this experimentation, we want to be able to explore, you know, isn't that the argument for charter schools? I mean, isn't this what the charter school people are telling us that they're doing with these little laboratories of innovation in our communities? Because I understand that's how it was supposed to work.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I know that there's some charter schools that might serve as models for the rest of the system, but here's the irony. They're under a lot of the same regulations and requirements that other public schools are under. They still have to take these tests, and they're using tech.
Because a lot of the people that I talk to here at this thing say they're exempt from most of those, and in Pennsylvania, some of them are exempt from the PSSAs as well.
Well, I know that the charter schools that I'm familiar with are still subject to them because they are public schools. They're taking taxpayer money. But the irony is that they're controlled by private boards. So to me, there's just an illogic there. It's my money. It's my taxpayer money. But right. It's being controlled by a private corporation. Just doesn't make any sense.
So on the state level, I mean, I imagine your piece has gotten some attention from the Department of Education in the state of Pennsylvania. Tell me about that.
The day after my op-ed came out, there was a letter from Tim Eller, who's a spokesperson for the Department of Education. It was called "The PSSAs Are Valid." Honestly, he didn't make that case, at least as far as I could tell. His question was, how are we going to be able to tell if the $27 billion that we're spending on public education is working? And I understand that that's kind of maybe an intuitive or common sense question. But over the years, as we've asked this question, we haven't, as a culture, turned to high-stakes standardized tests to answer that question. The other piece of data that I would sort of throw back to the Department of Education is that the best indicator of how a child is going to do on this test is that child's zip code and that child's parents' level of education.
Right.
So to me, we're testing schools that we know are going to do poorly because those schools are in bad zip codes and those kids have the least amount of resources of any of the children. In Pittsburgh or in these other poor communities in Pennsylvania.
And it's not just a Pittsburgh or a Philadelphia thing. This is a statewide thing because poverty just isn't isolated
in those cities. We're seeing it in Upper Darby, in Reading. I mean, it's pandemic. I mean, we're seeing the biggest gap between rich and poor since the 1890s.
You know, what do you say to the parent who goes, you know, I want to let my kids opt out. I want to save this, spare them from that suffering, from that, you know, that tension and all of that. But you know what? They're going to take a bunch of flack from their teachers. There are going to be repercussions from the school. I don't want to single them out.
You know, that's a parental concern I can really understand. I had some of those same concerns myself. I think one thing that the editorial revealed for me is how many parents are feeling this way. And I think when so many of us were able to see that so many others of us were feeling that way, that gave everybody a sense of power and confidence that this was the right decision, that this would ultimately protect all children if this movement can really catch fire and ultimately undermine and hopefully eradicate No Child Left Behind.
So basically what you're saying is when other parents realize that there are other parents thinking like they are, when you start thinking in a communal manner of a community, maybe that type of solidarity, that kind of unity builds empowerment.
I hope so. That's been my experience in the last 5 days.
So where do you see this going from here forward? Do you expect another response from the Pennsylvania Department of Education?
I imagine that they might be trying to change the rules to make it more difficult to opt out of the PSSAs next spring. But I think where I see the movement going long term is I do see it going towards candidate choice and towards elections and towards eliminating No Child Left Behind.
So what should we be doing on the local level? What should parents be doing?
I mean, I think we should be here. I think we should be here in D.C. I think Yinzercation, the grassroots movement we have in Pittsburgh, is a pretty easy model to follow. We have a wonderful, super committed, brilliant blogger, Jessie Ramey. She blogs sometimes once a week, sometimes three times a week. She's extremely informed. But there's hundreds of us that aggregate around her. And, you know, we figure out what's important to us at the moment, and we do it. It's a pretty easy model to follow.
And something we can do on our local level. Kathy, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much, and I appreciate your input. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back from Washington, D.C. at the Occupy the DOE 2.0. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Razor Tattoos presents Get On Board, an art show to benefit autism. Get On Board features custom, one-of-a-kind artwork on skateboard decks from nationally renowned tattoo artists and fine artists. All proceeds go directly to the Autism Society, Greater Harrisburg area. The initial public showing will be during the Derby, Inc. Invitational Tattoo Convention at the Farm Show Complex, April 19th through 21st. Visit facebook.com/getonboardforautism. That's facebook.com/getonboardforautism. Sponsored by Razor Tattoos.
Wall Streeters are all a Twitter about the comeuppance of Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. Last year, poor Jamie presided over a $6 billion loss by the bank's chief investment office. So he's now had his own pay cut in half, knocking him down to $11.5 million. I suppose that's really a come-downance, but by whatever name, having his paycheck whacked by J.P. Morgan's board of directors is widely viewed on Wall Street as a harsh rap on the knuckles. But ask about the board's actions? Dimon himself merely said, "I respect their decision." Of course he does. He walked away with his job intact, an $11.5 million wad in his pocket, and a sly grin on his face. Indeed, many investors and bank regulators, not to mention commoners, don't consider that level of, quote, punishment to be much of a deterrent to the kind of executive narcissism and carelessness that characterizes today's Wall Street elite. Yet, members of the bank's board are actually puffing out their chests, claiming to be bold bank directors. The vote to cut Dimon's pay, they say, shows that by gollies we're an effective take-charge watchdog over the top management of the nation's biggest bank. That they can even say something so absurd speaks volumes about the laissez-faire myth that corporations don't need government regulation since they have private boards that oversee them. Who are J.P. Morgan's directors? Lee Raymond, for one. In fact, he heads the board's compensation committee and took the lead in giving Dimon his haircut. But Raymond is congenitally gentle on CEO pay because he was a lavishly well-paid corporate chieftain himself. As CEO for ExxonMobil for 13 years, his paycheck totaled $686 million, $144,000 a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, corporate governance is a joke.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Heaven knocking on the door, there holds the throne. I've been looking for the map that leads me home. I've been stumbling on good hearts turn to stone. Good intentions gonna drive some home.
And welcome back. back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Hope you've enjoyed our coverage of Occupy the DOE 2.0. If you missed any portion of it, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, we've been talking to educators and professionals from around the country. We've been talking to concerned parents and activists. I've got with me the guy who wrote the book, a very clairvoyant book, if you will. I got Tom Petter. He's a professor at Miami of Ohio University. He's written the book, The Education of Sam Sanders, which is a novel, but yet very, very interesting in the look forward. Tom, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So, you know, you've written this book. When did you write it? Back in 2006, I think you said?
I started writing it in 2001. And I was involved with a group of educators, mostly professors, talking about the testing movement in 2000. And one of the things we decided to do, since no one was reading our research papers, was to work in the area of fiction and poetry and other sort of multi-genre areas. And we decided to do a work of fiction. And contributors like myself created a sort of a report or a booklet that was shared at the next conference. And that turned into a novella. I got some good feedback from colleagues and peers and students. And then ultimately over time, it turned into a three-part novel about a young boy named Sam Sanders who's in middle school who leads a walkout of the state test. The book is set in 2029. And one of the things I thought about was sort of creating a worst-case scenario based on where I thought we were going with this whole madness back in 2000. I set the book in 2029, and Sam Sanders, actually, those actual children are emerging all over the country because already citizens across the country see the madness of the testing movement, and students are walking out, and students are leading mass walkouts of tests all over the nation. And I'm gratified by that. I'm not really proud of it. I mean, I was writing what's essentially a horror novel about what could happen to us if we let this go so far. And it's gone pretty far. And I'm grateful that some people are reading the book and talking about it. But I hope for next steps, which is to somehow turn the tide. And students themselves and citizen parents and teachers, I think they are the front line of where the tide can turn. And hopefully today's work with Occupy 2.0 here at the DOE and all of the entities that are emerging across the nation will fight the testing regime.
The hope is, I hope you're right. But, you know, again, I think it comes back down to, as you pointed out, the students and the teachers. You know, you said 2029, you envisioned students walking out and not taking the test. I just talked to somebody yesterday. We're already seeing it in places like Denver and in Washington and all across the country.
We are seeing it. And I think that what comes home to roost is that students want to be valued in school. They want to have a great school experience. Teachers want to feel like the work they do is more than just delivering discrete bits of content knowledge for the production of the students, some sort of knowledge on a test that's disconnected from their work in the classroom. Students want to find meaning. They want to be inspired. Teachers want to enjoy their work. They want to be intellectual. You can't do that under a testing regime. So I think when things really go this bad, students and teachers will react, and they're reacting by walking out. In the book also, I predict some things that I thought might happen in the future. They're already happening. The first one is that the curriculum would become so standardized that every student would have their own curriculum on their own tablet and laptop, and that it would be somehow customized to them. But what it really is a dumbed-down version of very basic bits of knowledge that really don't lead to a robust sense of citizenship or how to be in the world, which students need to negotiate in school so that when they become citizens, they're able to do the things that citizens do.
Wow, you know, you say that, and I'm thinking of the television advertisements I see all the time of the bright, smiling little teenage kids saying, and it's the curriculum is designed specifically for me. It's made for me, personalized. Man, that just really strikes a chord.
It does strike a chord with people who think of education as a private good as opposed to a public good. And I think that citizens across the nation who understand the relationship between public education and democracy understand when there's one thing to individualize and help make the students journey toward selfhood a part of the social agenda of the school, it's one thing to individualize. It's another thing to create some type of weird, almost wacky, customized program that's distanced from any kind of interaction in the school. In Ohio, for instance, as in other states, they're developing virtual academies where the money follows the student. They can just stay home in their pajamas and go to school. But that's not really school.
No, that's...
That's not really education, because what you take out is what Dewey would call the democratic fabric of social life. You take out associative living. That's what people go to school for, not just to learn things in subject areas, but to become citizens of a democratic republic. They learn how to be together, work together, understand each other, fight and argue, and come to terms. This is what we do as a nation, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, because I've often asked about that, especially from a couple of people I know who do the homeschooling, who my homeschool friends think that they should be paid for teaching their child at home.
I've heard that, too.
I mean, which is part of this as well. I mean, part of that push is, well, you could homeschool and you would get, you know, whatever, $10,000, $15,000 a year, and you could actually make a living out of doing it.
That's right. In some states, I think that's almost an option now. Some of the things coming down from Supreme Courts around the country, for instance, Indiana's upholding of their decision to let voucher money follow students anywhere they want to go, is really a clear blow to public funding for public education.
Yeah, and I expect to see that in Pennsylvania at some point in the very near future, because we're following the national trends. You know, we're a little bit behind, but we're still following the trend.
Right. I think states like Pennsylvania and Ohio tend to do that. They tend not, perhaps, to be, I'll go on a limb and say, as conservative, maybe, as Indiana. And so they've taken, Indiana, I think, has taken very drastic steps, and I think other states may follow, especially as the state legislatures become more like they are across the Midwest.
You know, I look at this whole standardization of education, and I like to put things into sports terms, because to be honest, had it not been for sports, I would have never finished high school. It wasn't a priority.
Sure.
It was that extracurricular stuff is what kept me there and kept me doing the work that I needed to do to get through it. But I bring it back to sports, and you know, I think of friends who, you know, basketball, for instance, could never make a free throw. And you look at doing that to education. If every kid on the team had to be able to make 5 out of 10 free throws, I know a bunch of kids it's never going to happen.
Right. It doesn't mean they can't make a contribution.
So it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy the game and you can't learn from the game and you can't make yourself better, even if you can't meet that goal. And I guess the analogy I'm trying to make is you know, that everyone has their own abilities and has their own strengths and weaknesses. And to say that, well, the overall school will fail if 100% of the kids don't meet this standard number seems to me to be idiotic.
Yeah, well, it's parsing things down to the lowest common denominator. Playing your analogy out would mean that Shaq wasn't any good because he couldn't make 5 out of 10.
That's
he was
true.
One of the greatest centers of all time. So this is kind of the mad streak we're in. Linda Nathan was just on from Boston, and she gave a talk. At the end, she said that instead of doubling math and doubling reading during the school day, give students a paintbrush, a ball, give them the outdoors, give them a stage to perform on, and we'll see the best of our students come out, just like it used to in many of the best schools, public schools in the nation, from the 60s onward.
Well, what do you say
we know what to do.
What do you say to the person who says, well, that's what they should be doing at home? School is a place to work and to learn and to do math and to do those things.
I think some parents say that even in my local district, and I always respond to them and say that while they don't want the school necessarily to inculcate personal and social values that they want to do at home, in our republic, this is one of the functions of public schooling. It's what separates us from the rest of the world. We have strong home lives, some of them religious. We teach our children our values. But at school, we put them with well-educated adults to extend their education, to push their values, to question them, to maybe even criticize so that you can become an even better advocate for what you believe in, if that's the case. I think people who think that challenge yields to loss really don't understand how knowledge works. When you challenge and criticize and work in school, even your own values, a lot of times that strengthens them. And if it does lead to the point where you suspend them, well, then that's well and good. The educational process served its purpose. I think that parents around the country need to somehow work on that equation. I'm aware of the fact that many don't view it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it, and again, you go back to this whole idea that, that education's about, you know, just getting that job, you know, going, you know, the skills that you're going to gain for, you know, what you're going to do for the rest of your life seems to me to be short-sighted at best and destructive at worst.
Well, I'm a college professor, and I'm in front of students in a professional school every day of the week almost, and they're training, educating for teaching. And I tell them in my class that I can teach them certain things to do, like methods or techniques or practices, but what's really at stake is, why would you even do that in the first place? What is the background for making decisions of such a sort? These are the things that knowledge are supposed to give to students, the ability to critique, understand, and make sound, solid decisions. So a good liberal arts education should be the backbone of any citizen in the country.
You used that L word.
I did. But even
conservatives
use
liberal arts. See, that's what's wrong with
arts.
Is that liberal?
Well, maybe so. I don't know. It's always funny to me that people draw – I used the word conservative early when I was talking about Indiana, but and people do draw lines between liberal and conservative, but when we talk about the liberal arts in the university, we're talking about really the arts of thinking, asking questions, inquiring, and becoming more human as people. And we need more of that in our universities, which are also endangered by corporate takeovers and corporatization, and we need to really get that conversation back to public education, pre-K-12.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. Let's bring this back to your book,
sure.
The Education of Sam Sanders. How do we get it?
Oh, you can get it by going to Roman and Littlefield online. You can go to hamilton-books.com. Hamilton's an imprint of Roman and Littlefield, and it's available online. You can go and order the book. You can also find it at Amazon just by typing in the title or my name.
And we'll make sure we get a link at therickmithshow.com.
Thank
so you. So you can pick up this book from Tom Petter. You know, Tom, you know, let's talk about this a little. Where does Sam end up? I mean, you know, if the process is he's got this individualized curriculum on his own little personal tablet, you know, what happens to him?
It's a great question. In the novel, he has a subcategory of people in his life, including the librarian, the local librarian, some teachers and personal friends who encourage him to read. And in 2029, there are no books left. Everything is on tablets and computers. It's digitized.
Oh, see, but, now, this is one of those things that my son, who's just turned seven the other day, loves books.
Yes, good for him.
Loves books.
Good.
Hates the tablet. Hates the computer.
Get him books and have him reading books and holding them in his hand.
That's it. And
yeah.
Have I done him a disservice?
No, you haven't. You taught him really one of the secrets to a long and enjoyable life. And that
but you
is
just said at some point in the future they're going to do away with all
of them. They may, but one of the points of the book is that there are always remnants. Good things don't always disappear, and sometimes they can be reclaimed. And a good book never disappears, even the page-turning kind. So keep him reading books. In the text, Sam is energized by the knowledge he gains from books to think of a different way forward. And through the course of the book, he works with his parents and school teachers and even representatives from the state to create a new kind of school. And the new kind of school is a more progressive school where it's not just a child-centered environment. It's a child-centered environment where the teachers and students work together to come up with some type of social agenda forward. What is the good of learning together if it's not for some purpose? And in the book, I describe what that kind of education might look like.
And we want to take a look at the education of Sam Sanders. We've got a link at therickmithshow.com. Just click on Tom Petter's name. It'll take you right there. But, you know, right now it looks like we're moving education towards the sole function of, well, profit.
Yes.
Not so much for the betterment of people like Sam or people like my son Alex. You know, it's about money, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think
Or is that a cynical view?
I think it's an accurate view, and it's cynical in that I think corporate raiders have figured out that this is a market for them. Alex Molinar is a very famous, well-known curriculum person in the field of education who wrote a book called Giving Kids the Business in the late 90s, and he predicted this sort of corporate takeover if schools didn't work harder to keep schooling separate from corporate interests. And while businesses and other social entities and corporate entities and business entities and entities of political sorts have an influence to make on public schools because they're part of the equation too, they shouldn't be setting the agenda. And I think that's probably one of the biggest issues we have is corporations seeing the money that can be made in public education and homing in on it as a new market. And that's to be avoided at all costs. And unfortunately, I think that's probably one of the new status quos of the business, is that corporate interests are taking control.
I'm looking forward to taking a look at your book, The Education of Sam Sanders. We've got a link to where you can pick up the book at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Tom Petter's name. It'll take you right there. Tom, it was great talking with
Thanks,
you.
Rick.
I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Appreciate you having me on. I enjoyed it.
All right. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Freeway ride. If they slashed our funding, they cut all our hours by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did this all become all mine? The president says, I'm tightening the belt, the only one to tighten is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Power, we stand and fight together. There's power when we own the tide. Power, when we stand and fight together. There's power when we own the tide.
On now, it's back to the voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you've missed any of our coverage from Washington, D.C., from here at the Occupy the DOE 2.0 from our nation's capital, the website, that's the best place to go to get our podcast or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. I'm interested, curious, what your thoughts have been of our coverage of the last 2 days here from D.C. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We will be back in on Monday to talk more about this. This issue is not going away. This is important stuff. This is, well, to me, as we've been saying the last 2 days, this is the hill I do believe the working class of this country has to die on. The opportunity to make it to that next rung of the socioeconomic ladder. But more importantly than that, more important than, you know, how are we going to get to that next job? How are we going to get to that next promotion is, well, critical thinking, well-informed, activated, educated citizens. To me, that's really what it's all about. Next week, we're going to be talking about